All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago. Here until 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. I am your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and then at 6, it's Justin Kaufman, who's in for Steve Cochran this morning. So there you go. Coming up on the show in just a few minutes, Rod Pyle is going to join us. He is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, and he is a space expert. And this Saturday marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. So we have to talk to Rod about it and about the book that he wrote about Apollo 11 and the Ad Astra magazine, the 50th anniversary edition of Apollo 11, and lots of other space stories to talk about. It's always a lot of fun when Rod's here. So we will talk with Rod about space. And you can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. And we'll talk about his great book, beautiful, beautiful book about the Apollo 11 mission and 50 years this Saturday. And I'm sure that there's a lot of parties and stuff going on to celebrate that. So our space expert Rod is going to be with us in just a few minutes. And then a little bit later on in the show, Kevin Powell is going to join us. You hear him do sports on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis every weekday afternoon right here on WGN. You can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. He joins us once a month to chat about sports and other stuff. And so we've got a lot of sports stories to jump into and talk about. Kevin's a great guy, and we'll get him in here. We are also going to talk a little bit about how, you know, when movie titles are translated in different countries, sometimes the titles are pretty ridiculous. So we're going to have a little fun with that. And we also have the corporate logos that are most recognizable. We're going to jump into that, too. And the phone number here, it's Triple Play Thursday, too. You hear me? Triple Play Thursday. Triple Play Thursday, and that's one artist, three songs. We'll do that later, but get your requests in at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. And those are the best way to stay connected. And subscribe to our podcasts. Every single second of every single show is podcast. And so you can go to wherever you get your podcast or subscribe, or you go to iTunes or any of those places, and it's available. And you can subscribe, and the podcast will automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there it is. That's what's coming up on the show. 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. It's going to be fun to talk to Rod about that, too. Very disappointed that my Caddyshack screening last night was canceled, the outdoor screening, because of weather. It was raining pretty bad. It was windy. And so, they didn't want anything to happen to the equipment, the outdoor, the equipment that they would use, like this giant inflatable screen, and the equipment. And so they canceled it. And so, but we did hang out at Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant. A bunch of us did. And they showed it inside the restaurant. So we every single TV in the Caddyshack restaurant showed Caddyshack. So we had some good food. I want to thank the guys over at Murray Brothers Caddyshack. But we were all very disappointed that we weren't sitting out under the stars watching one of the funniest movies of all time. But it was a fun time anyway. So And I'm sorry. I apologize for it to be canceled for the people who came. Some people came a long way. But, you know, they got some good food and they got to see Caddyshack inside. So, anyway, that, and again, I just want to, thank the Murray Brothers Caddyshack guys. They're great. And, the next time I see those guys will be at Flashback Weekend, because Flashback Weekend, takes place, it's August 2nd through the 4th. And, we'll be talking more about it over the next couple of weeks, as we get closer. And we're going to have some guests who are going to be at Flashback Weekend. It's at the Crown Plaza. That's where the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant is. And so we'll be hanging out there in the first weekend of August. So, all right. All right, let me say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you? Are you there?
Yep, there we go. I'm good.
Yeah?
Getting ready. You know, I think I'm going to run to the supermarket tomorrow and get a dozen eggs and see if I can cook one of them on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Because I've always wanted to try it.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it happen, you know. I mean, this is going to be a ridiculous weekend. It's ridiculous. You know, I only have one window unit in my apartment, so I'm staying with my folks.
That's a good move.
So I can't bear hot weather. I can't stand it. So I'm going to be the weekend at my. I'm just going to spend the weekend at my parents, and then until I come back to work Sunday night, Monday morning, I'll go. I don't even want to deal with it.
And you got central air?
No, they don't, but they have like window units all over, and they live in a garden apartment.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah,
you know, I live on the second floor, and so, that'll take care of that. And then I'll come back, Monday morning to my apartment, and it'll be nice and muggy. It'll be nice and muggy in my apartment, and I'll have to turn on the dehumidifier that I bought. I bought a small dehumidifier because I had toilet tank sweat. As I was telling you before.
Yeah, I think I've had that before, but it wasn't on the toilet tank.
It's a common thing, actually. If you have a very sort of muggy, humid bathroom, you know, and when it's warm out, there does condensation forms on the tank and actually on the bottom of the toilet, too. And some of it drips out on the floor and stuff, and it's a real pain in the ass. But I got this little dehumidifier. I posted on my Facebook page. You know that you're really old when you think the best $45 you've ever spent was on a dehumidifier.
Mm-hmm.
The most satisfying $45 I've spent. And that thing works, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I put it on the floor and turned it on, and it took a little while, and then you just dump the water out. There's a little thing that you pull a little drawer out, dump the water out, put it back in, keep it going.
We used to have like five of those at the movie theater I worked at. Just sitting around the, I think it was last summer, there were some real hot days, especially in that old place, and we'd have to sit them around the projectors, because these massive things. Because otherwise it was just, there would be nothing showing because the projectors would fail.
Yeah, no, those things are great. Those small dehumidifiers.
Lifesavers.
They're great, man. It works perfectly. I'm going to get another one and probably put it in the bedroom, you know, or maybe like next to the couch where I spend most of my time. So... But anyway, so yeah, I mean, it's going to be really excessively hot. So everybody, please be careful. If you don't need to go out, don't go out. Stay in your air conditioning and look out for people who don't have AC or older folks. And then we'll get past it because it's all going to, like, by Sunday night, we should be, you know, the temperatures are going to drop. And by Monday, it's supposed to be like low 80s. Supposed to be something like that. So it's going to drop about almost 20 degrees between, which is just nuts. So, yeah.
Imagine saying it's going to drop 20 degrees into the 80s.
Yeah.
That's weird.
It's, you know what? I mean, this has happened in this city. It gets hot in this city. I mean, this is excessive and it's crazy and it's going to last all weekend. But yeah. And this is my least favorite time of year, man. I just hate it. I'm not a summer guy at all and I can't stand hot weather. So anyway, we'll get through this, and there you go. All right, listen, why don't we take a break here, and when we come back, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us, our space expert, and we will talk about Apollo 11th 50th anniversary and also a ton of other space news that we're going to get to as we talk to Rod. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us for talk or text. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. We'll play those a little bit later on. Coming up a little bit later this morning, our good friend Kevin Powell is going to join us from WGN Sports. You can hear him doing the sports on Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantes every weekday afternoon. And you can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. Lots of sports stuff to talk about with Kev. So let's talk about this. It is the Saturday is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and it's a very exciting thing, and everybody's very excited to celebrate that. And we wanted to talk about that and more with our good friend Rod Pyle. He's an author, a journalist, editor in chief at Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, and he's written a ton of books. Pylebooks.com is the website, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. He has put together a beautiful book called First on the Moon, The Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, and a foreword by Buzz Aldrin. And let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, how are you?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
Good, man. Good.
Other than really hot.
Oh, it's just going to be brutal this weekend. I mean,
you know, I feel for you guys because, you know, I live in a desert by choice, so we expect it to be 115 here in the worst of the summer.
Yeah.
But it's usually like zero humidity, and I just can't imagine what it feels like there now. It must be horrible.
Yeah, I mean, it really is not going to kick in until later this afternoon, and then it's going to be really brutal on Friday and Saturday, and then it'll taper off on Sunday, so...
You know, they could put a man on the moon, but you know the rest.
Yeah, exactly. Again, as we always do, tell everybody about yourself and how you got into writing about space.
So I was born the year before NASA and grew up with the first space race, which was a very exciting time to be alive. And by the... By 1970, really, we were seeing these incredible missions of exploration going off to the moon every couple of months, except for a couple of slowdowns due to Apollo 13, and a couple of them were delayed a little bit for other reasons. But basically, the program was just running full smash by 1971.
Yeah.
And it was just an incredible time to be alive and see that stuff. And, you know, even when I bemoan my aching joints and so forth, I feel very grateful I was alive for that. But... I'm also very optimistic because I think we're on the cusp of seeing it happen again, not just with government, but this time, as we've discussed before, with SpaceX and other companies.
Yeah.
And the international sector jumping in. It's going to be really exciting. So anyway, I got very excited about that as a kid. Wanted to be a scientist or an engineer and went off to UCLA to study astronomy and encountered differential calculus and decided I don't think I want to be an astronomer anymore. So that's what got me into the whole creative and writing end. And then by the mid-2000s, I was starting to write books, and it's just it's a lot of fun. It's a great way to make a kind of a living.
Yeah. It's nice to write about something that you really love and that you're incredibly interested in. You know what I mean?
So yeah. You know, it's a real gift. Yeah. And I thank my lucky stars every day. I make the commute from upstairs to downstairs. Today I had to go out and I've just been doing like a ton of media, 5 or 6 radio interviews a day. And
yeah.
Talk. So I was driving out across LA, which is, you know, across LA is about 28, 30 miles from where I live. To go out to Northrop Grumman, which is one of the big aerospace contractors, do a talk out there. And it took me an hour and a half to go that 28 miles. And I thought, boy, I'm glad I don't have to do this every day anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Well, first of all, what's the plans for I know this is a very, very busy time for you, obviously. But what is the plan for Saturday?
So Saturday, got kind of an interesting thing set up. I was sort of waiting on... There was a talk of going to Houston or to Florida to participate in some of the stuff there and maybe give a couple of talks, and it just didn't come together. And I was still two and a half months out maybe. And I thought, you know, I don't want to wait and be the guy sitting at home during the anniversary thinking, oh, I wish I was doing something cool.
Yeah.
So I got together with KFI, which is our big blowtorch talk station out here. And I'm on there every couple of weeks anyway, kind of like I do with you.
Yeah.
And I said, let's do a live broadcast from one of the science museums. So we set up a thing with the California Science Center in Los Angeles. So I'm going to be out there with a guy named Neil Saavedra, who does a show for them every Saturday. And we're going to do a 3-hour Apollo anniversary and interview some people and talk about space food and technology and play some clips from the era and all that. So it's just going to be a fun kind of a combined stroll down memory lane and looking at some of the cool technologies that made all this possible and where we're going.
Oh, that sounds fun, man. That sounds like a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
well,
and,
I'd rather do it with you, but if I can't have you, you know.
Well, it's interesting to, you know, to turn on my TV and check the cable listings. There seems to be an Apollo special on every channel every day.
Now, have you seen the CNN movie?
Yes, I have.
Called Apollo 11?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it twice now, and the second time I saw it in an IMAX theater, brand new print. And it was a museum IMAX theater, so it's one of those screens that's, you know,
oh yeah,
seven stories tall or
right,
something.
Right.
And I mean, you know, I grew up like you watching all that stuff in 16mm because that's all we thought we had. And in the 80s, I had a meeting. I got very lucky. I got a meeting with the chief of NASA's public relations division at headquarters because I wanted to make a documentary, and I thought they'd give me money. I was really kind of an idiot, but he was very nice. His name was Brian Duff. Really nice guy, great reputation.
Yeah.
Then he made, you know, 20 minutes to talk to me, and I said, is there any, towards the end of the discussion, when it was clear they had no money for me, I said, is there any large format film of any of the launches? And he said, see that corner of my office? I said, yeah. And he said, I had a stack of 35mm film cans of launch footage, and I could not get NASA to pay for it. After about 8 years, I gave up and sent it to the shredder.
Oh.
I was crushed.
Oh.
Not knowing, and I guess he didn't know or didn't remember, that there was this wide format 70mm footage sitting in the archives. So this guy who did the CNN doc found that and transferred it and cleaned it up digitally. And as you saw, it's just unbelievable.
It really
you
is.
You are right there.
Yeah, it really is. All right, so, Rod, hang on. Hang on a second, okay?
You bet.
You've got to take a break for the news. Rod Pyle is with us. He's our space expert. He's a great guy. And he has written a beautiful book about the Apollo 11 space mission. And it's the 50th anniversary this Saturday. We've got a lot more to talk about. Our phone number, if you've got comments or questions, is 312-981-7200. The news is up after this.
1 second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Up.
How did this song not win Best Song at the Academy Awards?
I don't know.
How did it not win?
I don't know how he didn't get the Oscar for Al Cody. Who is that? Adam Driver,
yeah,
playing Al Cody.
He was hilarious. I love that song. It's a great movie, too. Inside Llewyn Davis.
Breaks my heart every time.
It's so great. Why am I blanking on her name? Carrie, the female lead.
Oh,
British. Oh, my God. Why am I blanking on her name? Anyway, Oscar Isaac is great in it. A great cast.
So, Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, JT's in it. That's a great movie, a really great movie, and that song is hilarious. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Coming up a little bit later on, our good friend Kevin Powell is going to join us for some sports talk. You can hear him on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantes every weekday afternoon right here on WGN. So we'll do some sports talk, too. Right now, though, we are approaching the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, and we're celebrating that right now. It's Saturday, and we got to talk to Rod Pyle about that and much more, and let's get Rod back on the show. Hi, Rod.
Hi,
Rod.
Hey, Nick.
Hey. So let's talk about the book, First on the Moon. We've talked about it before, but because the anniversary is coming up, tell me about how this book was put together and when you started it and all that cool stuff, because it's really a beautiful book.
So I think it started in 2016 early. It's one of these author's dreams where I got a call from the publisher saying, hey, we want you to do a book. I didn't have to pitch it. I didn't have to write a proposal or anything. I just started working on it. And I'd done two Apollo books before that and kind of a third partial Apollo book. So I already had a lot of stuff. You know, I'd done that Missions of the Moon where I had all those scanned documents and I'd taken photographs of hardware and so forth. So I had this huge library of stuff in addition to things I'd pulled from the archives over the years. So really putting it together was a matter of picking the right things and just writing the text. But I wanted to do something a little different because so many of these things are just a chronological, you know, this happened, this happened, this happened. Then we landed on the moon and the world rejoiced. And those are fine. But I knew there was going to be probably 20 or 30 books out this season because of the big anniversary. So if I wanted to do something a little different, so I just picked areas that I thought were really critically important and interesting, like the key machines and the process of getting to this decision of going to the moon and what it meant to NASA to suddenly have President Kennedy say in 1961, hey, NASA, we're going to the moon. I know we only have 15 minutes of experience in space and we didn't even reach orbit, but make it happen. And they kind of went, yay, how are we going to do this? And then one real special thing was I wanted to interview the kids of Aldrin and Armstrong. And so I interviewed one of each of their sons. And both the interviews were a lot of fun. Armstrong's son's a little bit like him. You know, you got to kind of chat him up to get the material. Andy Aldrin I had known for a number of years already. And we work on a board together and we've done some other stuff. So he's kind of a friend. And he just gave me this killer interview for about an hour and a half. And I think I've told this story before, but if you don't mind, I'll tell it one more time.
Yeah, please.
At the end of the interview, I said, is there anything else? And usually, you know, by the time you've talked to somebody for an hour and a half, they say, no, that's about it. He said, yeah, if you don't mind, I'd like to tell you a story I've never told another writer. And I'm like, oh, yeah, please. And he said, you know, when my dad was on the moon, I wasn't worried that his spacesuit was going to rip or fail because I knew NASA was the best. And I wasn't worried they were going to get stranded in the lunar module because I knew that NASA tested everything until it was perfect. What I was most afraid of at the age of 11 was there was this wire going from the lunar module to the radio dish they had set up. And it was kind of coiled up. It wasn't lying flat on the moon. And I was scared to death my dad was going to trip over that and embarrass me in front of my friends. And I thought, you know, teenage boys are the same everywhere throughout history. So that was a real pleasure. And just the whole book was just a real thrill to put together. And the pictures, one more thing I'll add, it says in the back, you know, previously unseen pictures, which is marketing copy. But what happened was NASA had released a bunch of stuff in 2015, early 2016, a bunch of photos that had been sitting in the archives, but almost nobody pulled them out because during the space race and shortly thereafter, NASA pulled out all the best pictures. They showed them to the public, sent them to the newspapers and the TV stations and all that. But the other stuff, which in some cases is an accidental picture of a boot because they accidentally bumped the shutter.
Right.
Or most of them are like a panorama. So there's like 10 pictures taken, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in order. And you can put them together and get these incredible compositions. So I hired this photo compositor I knew from my TV days and said, can you put these together afresh and make them perfect? Because there's one famous one we've seen a bunch of times of Buzz Aldrin in the lunar module shortly before they got into lunar orbit. And it's a composite of about 6 different pictures, but it shows them having like three arms on one side because of the different exposures and he moved. So this guy went in and picked up from other photos, pieces of the instrument panel and all that. He just made them perfect. So there's a bunch of these in the book. They're on the orange pages.
Yeah.
That show these pictures that we have either never seen or never seen composited like this. And that was just really, really fun to do. And that made it feel special.
Yeah, it is a really gorgeous book. You know, I've gone through it many times I still have mine here at work. I have it in front of me right now, First on the Moon. But I'm not lying here, Rod. Your coffee table book on Mars is on my coffee table at home.
Well, that's a plus, although you're not going to be there this weekend, right?
No, I'm not. I'm not. But first of all, you know, I know, where does the book start? Where do you begin?
It kind of starts with right in the middle of the landing, because I thought, you know, this is was the most intense time. If you were alive then, you were glued to the radio or the TV, but there was no video because the only stuff they sent down in video was the actual moonwalk, and the video was pretty awful. So the only thing we have from the landing is the radio link and 16-millimeter footage shot out the window, which we, of course, didn't see until they got back.
Yeah.
They got processed because that was film back in the bad old days. So I really wanted to add some of the details that we didn't understand at the time, like the fact the computer locked up 5 times during the landing, and they weren't sure if they were going to be able to finish the landing or not because the computer failed. They were done. They had to abort and try and find their way back to the command module where Mike Collins is waiting. So that was a white knuckler. They were off course. When they separated the lunar module from the command module, there's a little bit of residual air in that docking tunnel. And it just was the slightest little pop like a champagne cork, but just that extra air was enough to throw them off course and downrange 3 miles. So Armstrong's getting down close to the surface, and he realizes, these aren't the craters in the mountains I'm supposed to be seeing. I got to land this thing manually right on the edge of the map where they had drawn this big oval for the landing zone. So he was kind of in luna incognita, if you will.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a white knuckler, and we didn't know that at the time, of course, because he wasn't really saying much. He said, we're a little long. Well, NASA knows what that means, but the rest of us are going, what's that mean?
Yeah.
You know, they talk about what a mani is or something? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of stuff happening that was just kind of in the subtext that we only found out later. So I really wanted to get in that narrative. And then I go from there to the beginning of the whole space race and how it happened, of course, because you have to talk about that.
Sure.
And then, like I said, I go off into the different machines, because the Saturn V was a huge accomplishment for that era. And we were only a decade and a half out of the Second World War when all this started. And here they are building this magnificent 363-foot-high moon rocket that's the size and about the same mass as a World War II destroyer. And it's got to fly, you know?
Mm.
It's this big, controlled bomb. And the lunar module was the first machine of its kind designed to operate only in space. Very thin, very fragile. Computers were tiny. They had about 36K of memory. They're very primitive. They're about as powerful as a handheld four-function calculator back in the old days.
Yeah.
So all these things together, I thought, just really would make a compelling story.
Yeah. Well, it's really, really great stuff. But talk a little about the three guys. You know, I mean, I've seen First Man, and I know that, you know, and I loved that. I really loved that movie. But, you know, I've talked to you about how some of the inaccuracies of the personalities that they showed in the film. But talk about these three guys and you know, their camaraderie and how they got along and their personalities.
So they were kind of an unlikely crew. You know, that, excuse me, Deke Slayton, who was the head of the astronaut office at that point, he was a grounded astronaut because he had a heart condition. He was supposed to fly in Mercury, but didn't fly till the last Apollo flight. Kids always said, you know, you can interchange my crew guys like cogs in a machine, and it'll always work. That might have been a little bit of an overstatement, but really, you could put any of these guys on a crew, and they would be fully functional and get the job done.
Yeah.
So as Mike Collins wrote after he got back from that mission and left NASA, and he wrote a couple of excellent books, one called Carrying the Fire, in which he says, we were amiable strangers. And he goes on to say that they worked well together as a team. They communicated fine. They trained for hundreds and hundreds of hours together. And they operated perfectly like a machine, but they probably wouldn't have been friends under other circumstances. Uh-huh. So Armstrong is this very quiet, not taciturn, not like he is in the film, but quiet, introspective, intensely curious guy. I mean, he was a real scientist engineer right to his bones.
Yeah.
Had a very wry sense of humor. If you talk to people that knew him, he's the only one of that trio I didn't have the fortune to meet. And just a magnificent pilot. I mean, the guy flew the X-15. You know, that's not easy to do.
Yeah.
As we saw in the film,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So, First Man. So, really just the right guy at the right place for the right job. And when it came to that final part of the descent, and I was on a panel a couple of days ago over at Northrop Grumman here in L.A., I had a couple of guys who were on the team that designed and built and really invented the lunar module descent engine, and they were saying what a magnificent job he did setting that thing down with just 20 or 30 seconds of fuel left, really flying it right to the edge of the capability of the machine and the people, and so he was just the perfect choice.
Yeah.
Buzz Aldrin, very intense, the only astronaut of that group that got a PhD. He got it at MIT and orbital dynamics, I think it was, or orbital mechanics, which was fairly new at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, just reading the course descriptions give me a headache, because the guy's brilliant. He's got five brains in there all kind of working at once.
Yeah.
Didn't mesh terribly well with the other guys who were test pilots. He wasn't a test pilot. And when they wanted to tell stories about, you know, the Korean War, their experiences in aerial combat, or their latest conquest or something, and there was Buzz wanting to talk about orbital dynamics and science, and they just kind of didn't get him.
Yeah.
And he tended to speak exactly what he thought, as you saw in the film.
Yeah.
Is, you know, a little over the top, but,
yeah,
but I guess from what people tell me that were there, fairly accurate. And then you've got, so he was just a perfect choice for his role of being, they called him the lunar module pilot, but really he was the guy manning the second stick in case he needed to take over, but watching the computer as they were descending, telling Armstrong exactly where they were and how fast they were going and how fast they were descending and all that.
Right.
And the other thing about Aldrin, as I've said a couple of times your show, is he understood the whole thing of orbital dynamics so well that when on Gemini 12, when their flight computer failed, it was the last Gemini flight, and they were trying to rendezvous with an Agena target vehicle to finish proving docking and rendezvous and all that kind of stuff. The computer failed, and he got out a sextant and a slide rule and a piece of paper and a pencil, and calculated the whole thing by hand, and they actually made their objective and docked using less fuel than anybody previous.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So that's amazing.
Yeah.
And finally, you know, he's the one of that bunch that just never gave up on the message of we got to push further, we got to push harder, we got to keep going. He really has represented ever since the day he came back, really. Mm-hmm. Collins is a kind of a classic raconteur. You know, he was a combat pilot. He was a test pilot. Great sense of humor. Real interest in history and the humanities. He was the kind of guy that you wanted at your barbecue because he could hold forth on just about any subject.
Yeah.
He was a connoisseur of fine wines and French food and a chef and all that kind of stuff. So really, you couldn't pick three more diverse individuals to work together on something like this. Now, you look at the next crew on Apollo 12, and you got Pete Conrad and Al Bean and Dick Gordon. And these guys were like brothers. They loved each other. They spent every moment they could together. And this was really, I think, mostly because of Conrad's personality. He was a great leader and just a warm, loving guy. And he treated these guys like they were family. So completely different picture. And then from there on out for the rest of the flights, slightly different bunch for each one. But that's probably the biggest contrast between two crews is Apollo 11 and Apollo 12.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He is an author, an expert on space, and it is the 50th anniversary this weekend of Apollo 11 and his fantastic coffee table book, First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, is truly great. All right, we'll talk more with Rod. We got more space stuff to talk about, not just Apollo 11, but of course, obviously we were leading with that because Saturday is the 50th anniversary. We want more. If you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Triple Play Thursday, a little bit later on, 312-981-7200. Coming up, the stories that matter with Ken Smith in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 mission is this Saturday, and we are talking with Rod Pyle, who is an author and a journalist. He's an editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and he's the author of many books, including this really beautiful coffee table book called First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. And let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Hey, you know what? While during the break there, I was like tooling around online, and I found this really amazing picture, which I'm sure you've seen, of eight astronauts from the Apollo missions who gathered together and took a picture. And have you seen this picture?
Probably. It doesn't ring a bell right away, but I've seen most of them one time or another.
This was a few months ago. They gathered together in March and they took a picture. And have you seen Buzz Aldrin's outfit in this?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Everybody's in a suit, and here's Buzz in, I think it was one of your Get Your Butt to Mars t-shirts, although I'm paraphrasing there.
Yeah.
And stars and stripes suspenders, and on his left wrist, if you see closely, he's got a bracelet of crystal skulls, and on the other wrist, he's got turquoise beads. And I mean, he's just a real trendsetter, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful picture, though. It's very, very cool.
It's really nice they got together.
Everybody in tuxes except for Buzz Aldrin.
Right? Hey, that's his thing, man.
Yeah. Hey, tell us about the of Ad Astra. You guys have the 50th anniversary edition of Ad Astra. Tell us all about that.
So I wanted to do something special for the anniversary in print, and I'd already done the book, and I was editing the magazine anyway, and I thought, you know, let's do a special edition. So I commissioned it to be almost 100% over length, so it went from about 50, 60 pages to 100, and put on a nice heavy stock gloss cover, and I knew there were going to be a bunch of special edition magazines out, although there weren't as many as I expected, but most of them are, you know, articles that are interviews with some of the astronauts and a retelling of the story. But I really wanted to get some of the stories that we don't hear much about. And I got so many, in fact, that I'm having to overlap a bunch of them into the next couple of issues. But there is one on, we did an interview with Buzz about a year ago, which went on for quite some length. And he talked a little bit about his experiences and then a lot about the future and, you know, working with China and so forth. And then there was another very comprehensive article about building the Apollo capsule, the command module, and how challenging that was, and the different iterations of it. Another one about the lunar module that I wrote. And then a couple of profiles on the crews. I reprinted the stuff from the kids interview that I did.
Yeah.
Of the sons of the astronauts. So just kind of an eclectic collection of things. Then one big whopper, I think it's 4,000 word article that I wrote that was an excerpt from the, it was kind of an amendment of what I'd put in the book. I took two or three of those chapters on the actual process of getting there, landing, and what they did on the surface. So that was kind of the large centerpiece of it.
And is it, can people get it?
Yeah, it goes to all members, but we just yesterday, actually, or this morning, I take it back, this morning, we got it online on a site called Issue, ISSUU. So if you look there under Ad Astra, and I sent you the link, maybe you can put it up later.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'd love
it. Buy it for $6, which is about a third the price of any of the other special editions out there.
Oh, that's great, man. That's really great. Okay, one more Apollo thing before we break here. Sure. There is an Apollo 11 immersive live show. Tell us about that.
So this is a guy. This was put together by a guy named Lucas Biglietti, who I know he lives in Switzerland, and he's a really fascinating guy. I met him at a conference years ago. He is a pilot, so he flies for, I think, Swiss Air. And he flies the big heavy passenger flights across the Atlantic. But he just has this undying love for Apollo. So years ago, he opened this museum in Switzerland called the Swiss Apollo Museum, fittingly. And they had contributed to one of the experiments on Apollo 11, so that was sort of the centerpiece of it. And he decided, he too wanted to do something special for the anniversary. So he got together with some investors and some theater people, raised $15 million. And so they debuted this in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, our big stadium here.
Yeah.
And it's this huge tent, holds, I think, 800 or 1,000 people, and it's an audience on three sides of the stage. So the first half is kind of like traditional museum theater, which you might see. There's a lot of explaining about what was important and why it mattered and some of the intricacies of going there. And it takes the form of a grandfather telling his granddaughter about what this all meant to him and why it's still important. And she's looking at her phone, and he says, "Stop looking at your phone and listen to me." You know, a lot of things you might kind of expect.
Yeah.
And then in the second half, it just takes off, and the staging and the theater craft in this is jaw-dropping. So I'll just mention a couple of things. These aren't spoilers because they've already been written up elsewhere. There's this cylindrical scrim about 25 feet across that comes down from the ceiling in the beginning of the second half. And you're thinking, what's that going to be? And it's pre-launch, and they slowly, with a CGI that's projected inside the cylinder, they do a build-out of the Saturn V from the inside out digitally.
Wow.
And then this big rocket sitting in front of you, and it looks life-size, and then it takes off. So they slowly lift this scrim, and there's steam and fire coming out the bottom, and it's all lit up, and the seats are shaking because these speakers and so forth. So the rocket takes off. And then the other highlight, which was just sensational, was across the back of the stage, they have the mission control team facing you over their consoles.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's the landing. And they're going through the high points of the landing. It's very intense, and there's intense music, and the lighting is low. And then from that same cylinder in the ceiling is lowered what looked to me to be a life-size mock-up of a LEM. The quad jets are firing, the main engine's firing, and it comes down, lands in the middle of the stage. And it goes on from there. And I got to tell you, with no shame whatsoever, I lasted about halfway down vertically, and then I started to just sob because it just brought it all back.
Yeah.
It's so visceral and so present. It was amazing.
And
so,
it's coming to Chicago.
Well, it's traveling, and I'm pretty sure Chicago's on the agenda. I asked, and they said, well, we're working all that out. We have to get the venues lined up. But it is traveling. So over the next 3 years, it'll be going, I think, to 15 cities. So I'm pretty sure Chicago's one of them.
That's great.
And the website is apollo11show.com if anybody wants to check it out.
apollo11show.com. apollo11show.com.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Rod, hang on, okay?
Yeah. You betcha.
All right, Rod is with us. Rod Pyle is with us. We got more space to talk about. We got to get to the news, which is coming up in just a couple of minutes. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a starman. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Justin Kaufman in for Steve Cochran starting at 6. Coming up a little bit later, in the show, our good friend Kevin Powell is going to join us from WGN Sports. He does the sports on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantes every weekday afternoon. You can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. We'll get him in here to talk sports. But right now, we're talking with Rod Pyle, our good buddy here, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, and author of just a lot of books, including a beautiful one about the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, which is Saturday. So let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, one of the news stories that Ken Smith just did in his newscast is this whole Area 51 thing. This whole Area 51. And I just wanted to throw it at you to see what you, because I think it's hilarious. I think it's absolutely hilarious. And from your point of view, what you've been seeing this, and what do you think?
Yeah, well, I saw it and I thought, boy, I got to put this hashtag in my tweets because it's going to get a whole lot more attention than Apollo 11 or the stuff I usually put in there. It's you know, I appreciate the gag. It's something kind of that you might expect out of The Onion. My only concern is, you know, if you do get a big mass of people there, it's going to be really hot. It's a really horrible time of year to be out there.
Yeah.
Because it's in the middle of the freaking desert. And those guys are serious, you know.
I'm
sure they'll be, you know, if they think it's going to happen, the troops there will be set up for it. And I don't think they're going to certainly shoot anybody, but they're not going to be friendly about it. And the few accounts I've read of people who tried to, you know, not only is there the perimeter fence, but there's also signs over the place just in the hills surrounding the area saying, don't come any closer. Lethal force may be used.
Yeah.
They're not messing around. You know, they've got military secrets there they want preserved. So my fear is that enough people take this seriously that they show up and make this kind of ragtag assault with their motorhomes or whatever. It's going to be like that scene out of your favorite movie, Independence Day, with all the motorhomes crossing the desert, you know, with American flags whipping off the back and guys on motorcycles going, let us in. What do you think? I mean, I guess what amazes me the most is how much traction this gets.
That's
so
what I'm talking about.
Celebrating.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm. That's exactly the my takeaway from this too. Is 1.5 million attendees on the Facebook page? What are we talking about here? And I also love the way it's. I also love the way it's worded. They can't stop all of us. Is what I just. It's been this. The story's been cracking me up all week. You know,
it's the kind of thing you expect. You know, in the fall of the Soviet Union or something, but not here and not for this reason. And it's just amazing. And I was talking to somebody about this on another station earlier today. They were saying, what do you think the attraction is to these kinds of conspiracy theories, you know, these ideas? And I really think, and I don't mean this to sound at all dismissive, because I know that people get very passionate about this stuff, and I welcome this sense of curiosity, but I think there's kind of a seductiveness to these kind of conspiracies, whether it's Area 51 or the Apollo landing, moon landing deniers. You know, you don't need to go do all the work to get a master's or a PhD in a subject to be a part of it. You just get to read some crazy stuff on the internet and say, this really fires me up.
Right, right.
And I'm excited about it. Now, if you can channel that, and you know, I can't say that there aren't UFO pieces at Area 51. I don't know, because I've never been there.
Yeah.
And they're not interested in having me come in to write about it, for sure.
Right.
So who knows? You know, there are probably some secrets within the government that we'd like to know more about. Is it that one? I kind of don't think so, but I can't say no for sure. But this isn't the way to find out more.
Yeah,
you know?
It's just. But I just think I find it endlessly amusing. I don't know why. This story cracks me up. You know, and it's one of those stories. Like we've had. You know, the news lately has just been sort of ridiculously depressing. You know what I mean? Like, and just tear my hair out every time I watch the news. But we've had some relief from that. I don't know if you. I'm sure. I think it made it nationwide news. We had a loose alligator in a lagoon here in Chicago, in the city, and
Somebody's pet that went rogue.
Yeah. And somebody threw. Yeah. I think we thought it was somebody. It got too big for the person, and they put it in the lagoon.
Right.
And it was in this lagoon in the middle of the city, right in the middle of the city. And it became thing. It was like Gator Watch, and people were, you know, they named him Chance the Snapper, and. And all the local news has been covering this alligator thing. Finally, some dude from Florida was flown in. He got it was all weekend we were covering this. For like 4 days, people were covering this. And everybody was going down to this Humboldt Park Lagoon. You know, like hundreds of people were going down trying to find the alligator and look for the alligator. And finally, an alligator a trapper from Florida came in, found it in a day. And now he's like, you know, this guy's a hero. He threw out the first pitch at the Cub game the other day. The alligator has been, you know, taken all over the city, and now it's on its way to Florida to an alligator farm where it's going to live its life and be happy. But this was like one of those distracting, you know, news stories followed on its heels by this thing, by this Area 41 thing. It's just Area 51 thing. So if it's not an alligator story giving us a little relief from the news, then I'll take the Area 51. So.
Well, and there's something about animal stories. I remember there's a friend of mine named Ian O'Neill who edits another magazine for a group called the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. And he was a journalist at Discover News for a long time and so forth. He's another space guy. He's actually got a PhD in heliophysics, I think.
Yeah.
Or solar astronomy. And he wrote this story years ago when there was a shuttle launch that was delayed. And somebody spotted a little black speck off of the orange external tank. And they thought, what's that? It turned out it was a bat that had gone up and kind of set up shop on the side of the external tank. And so, you know, just for fun, he started writing this series of stories and tweets and so forth about Bruce the Bat, as he named it.
Right.
What's going to happen to Bruce when the shuttle takes off? Well,
right.
Of course, Bruce is going to unhook and fly away, hopefully, and make it far enough that he's not going to be incinerated. But it became this major thing, and it kind of made his career. You know?
Yeah.
And it's just this cute little thing. It's funny, you talk about alligators and crocs. I mean, I go to Houston occasionally, and you drive around the area where the JAXA Space Center is. There's alligators all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, they're sunning themselves. There'll be a little river going up towards the suburban neighborhood, and there's a gator there sitting on the grassy slope, just kind of minding its own business.
Right.
They're used to it, so it's no big deal. But I can imagine in Chicago, it's kind of a rarity.
Oh, no. It was like the top story. The coverage of this was insane. And
it's nice relief. Huh?
Yeah, it was great. And it was really a lot of fun to follow that along. And I just found it really interesting that when this whole thing started, Rod, it was a couple of days before last weekend, and the movie Crawl opened up last weekend, and it's an alligator. It's an alligator attack movie. So there were alligators.
Right.
There were alligators all over. I mean, it was completely insane. But we'll see what happens with this Area 51 thing. I just think, you know, when it hit 1.5 million attendees, I was like, you got to be kidding me! Unbelievable.
Well, and I hope most of them are just kind of tagging along because I think it's fun. You
know,
I wonder what the real number is of people who are dedicated enough to actually try something like that, because it's a big trek. That's not a fun part of the state to be in. You know,
yeah.
It's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
That's why they're there, right?
Yeah, exactly. September 20th is when they were thinking about doing
Man.
This. So anyway, I just, you know, since it was in the news, you know, report, I wanted to mention it to you and see what you thought.
Well, this reminds me of that guy, what was it, about 6 months ago, 9 months ago, that guy, the flat earth guy, flew his rocket because he wanted to get high enough to see that the earth was flat and prove it to everybody.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I think you got up to 5,000 feet or something, and you want to say, dude, go in an airplane. You're getting a jet. They go up to 36,000 feet. You can see everything. But instead, he goes up this thing, gets all banged up when it comes down. And I just thought, this is wackiness made tangible. I mean, he spent a good chunk of his adult life and probably all of his savings building this thing.
Yeah.
And we've seen a lot of rockets fly, and they're better than his. So that's not the way to go. But what are you going to do? You know.
All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
Yeah, Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. We've got some general space stories that Rod wants to talk about. And again, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 on Saturday. And a great way to do it is to pick up a book by Rod. You can check out pylebooks.com. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we've got more space stories. And if you guys want to jump in, if you have space stories or questions or anything like that for Rod, he's here. And it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Wow, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiCilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Be coming up later on. It's One Artist, Three Songs, 312-981-7200. Kevin Powell's going to join us a little later to talk sports. Right now we're talking with our buddy Rod Pyle, who's a terrific writer, author, journalist, expert on space. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
You know, it's interesting that this is a, you know, we got a text here from someone. If anybody has a question, space related question and or an interest, it's talk or text at 312-981-7200. Dan says, aren't all orbit missions and even International Space Station below protection of Van Allen belts? No real prolonged time in radiation, and our eyes a weak spot, saying we are blind to time to Mars. Not sure what that means.
I think what he's talking about, so it's below the most of the magnetosphere, which is what protects us, so the Van Allen belts are part of that, protects us from radiation from space. There's radiation coming from the sun, there's radiation coming from outside the solar system, from all those nasty things out in deep space, further out in the galaxy and beyond. And so when we're in Earth orbit, we're protected from most of that, which is why the space station is such a handy place to do the research we do there. Once you get out to the moon and Mars, there's just all this raw radiation coming in, which goes up many, many times higher as you get out towards Jupiter and Saturn. So, yeah, space is rich with radiation, and it's very dangerous, and we have a lot more work to do to figure out how to protect astronauts from that. It's going to probably involve mostly physical shielding and maybe some electromagnetic shielding if they get that put together. So I think what he's talking about when it comes to eyes is we've seen with Scott Kelly and so forth, when you're in weightless conditions for a long time, your eyes elongate, or I guess they flatten out, so your vision goes south. Usually it's temporary, but not always, and it seems to affect men more than women. And, you know, your bones get brittle because they're no longer being stressed by gravity, and there are all these other changes that take place. Calcium builds up in your system and so forth. So it is a problem. The simple solution to that is to figure out how to engineer a centrifuge on the spaceship so you can spin it where the crew quarters are and give them artificial gravity. Mm. It doesn't have to be full gravity from Earth. It can be partial, they think, and that'll be good enough. But it's not something we've tried yet, so we don't really know if it'll work as effectively as we want or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, that leads into the first story that that you wanted to talk about, which was radioactive astronauts.
Yeah, so there's another study that came out. So a few years ago, there was a study done, looking at a large group of astronauts, about 400-something of them, trying to see if the radiation of space caused cardiovascular issues. So they looked at astronauts that had never flown. They looked at astronauts that had flown Earth orbit. And critically, they looked at the Apollo astronauts, because they were the ones that went out beyond this magnetosphere we're talking about into the more radiation-saturated environment. But those trips were very short. You know, the longest was about 2 weeks, the Apollo flights. And there aren't that many of them. You know, there's only a handful, a couple dozen that went out to the moon and back. So really, it's hard to gather good data from that. But just to make sure, you know, that's just me. So I called a flight surgeon I knew at Johnson Space Center, NASA's center there. And so what do you think? And he said, we're all kind of turning our noses up at it because there just isn't enough good data here. So then this other study comes out recently, which I don't know if it was the same data or a different set. It wasn't clear. But it said, you know, we've looked at this and we've done the best we can. And it was 310 American astronauts, 117 Russian cosmonauts. And there's, you know, complete medical histories in all these people from the time they're young on through their career.
Yeah.
And the Apollo guys. And they said, we just don't see a correlation there. So we know there's danger. We just don't know what it is. The concern with this one was that, you know, it could be a deadly thing to go to Mars. There's also concerns that it might mess up your cognitive function, and you don't want drowsy astronauts who can't think clearly trying to land on Mars. So there are valid concerns here. This just isn't the best way to look at them yet.
And so when these different studies happen, how often have they done studies regarding the radiation issue?
Well, they've done tons of them. It's just, again, you don't have much data to deal with. You've just got the Apollo guys that have left the magnetosphere, left Earth orbit. So the other stuff they've looked at is by sending out sensors. There was famously a radiation sensor on the Curiosity rover activated while it was on its way to Mars and has been activated while it's been on the surface. And it has given us a lot more data points about how much radiation is out there. And we know from people that have worked in nuclear plants, or especially if you were, you know, one of the guys that went in after the Chernobyl or Fukushima accident, or if you were part of the group that suffered from the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombings, you know, we've got well-documented evidence of what happens when you get excessive doses of radiation, but putting it together with extended spaceflight is tricky.
Mm, yeah. Well, we also know what happens with a lot of radiation. Godzilla.
Yes. And it's now, isn't that an amazing thing that lives on? I had a friend that was teaching English in Japan in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. And he was there when they were filming another rubber suit Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
You know, those just never go away.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody stole the Godzilla suit.
No.
And this became a national crisis.
Oh,
I mean, it was all over the news. They're pleading, please bring it back. No questions asked. Here's a bounty. I mean, it was this national emergency.
Wow.
Because Godzilla-san had been made off with, and I thought, hey, you got to have your priorities. You know, we worry about presidential administrations and excessive heat warming across the country, and they were worried about their rubber suit.
Well,
so that, my answer was make another one.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's actually, you know, as a ridiculous Godzilla fan, and I am a ridiculous Godzilla fan, when you said that, I was just like, like that was, I seriously was like, somebody stole a Godzilla suit? That's so.
Okay, so did you see the new movie?
I did. Did you?
How was it? I didn't know. I saw the one before that, which I found a little confusing, but I kind of liked, especially that was the one with all the giant ticks in it.
Yeah.
That one a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when Godzilla, you know, breaks open the jaw of that thing and breathes fire down its
mouth,
I thought, you know, it was worth the price of admission just for that.
Oh,
what
yeah.
was the new one like?
I loved it. You know, Tom and I, Tom, my producer, is another Godzilla maniac, and it was not well received. It was very negatively received. But I thought it was great. I thought they made a very good, typical, wonderful Godzilla movie, and I was happy about it.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Rod, can you hang out for a minute?
You bet.
Okay, good. Rod Pyle is with us. We got more space stuff to talk about. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk or text. And we'll break here. The news is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Kevin Powell is going to join us to talk sports after 3, and we got a lot of sports stuff to talk about, and he'll be joining us to talk that. And then we're going to be talking about how movie titles get translated in different countries and how hilarious some of these are. We also have some corporate logos that everybody recognizes we can chat about, too. The phone lines and the text lines are open. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And we are talking with our good friend Rod Pyle, who is a great author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. Again, the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 is on Saturday, so we had Rod to talk about that. There are other space things to talk about, so let's bring Rod back. Rod, thanks for hanging out with us.
You got it, sir.
All right. Another thing you wanted to talk about was space spinoffs. Let's talk about that.
So this is an old story for NASA. They've been publishing a publication called Spinoffs, interestingly enough, since the 60s. And we've all seen the documentaries. They talk about, you know, modern computing came from NASA, and all the money invested in the program goes back into the economy, which is true. And what they don't say often enough is two things for my money. One, that money isn't launched into space. It's spent here on the ground on American workers and American products. And two, it's one of the few things that government spends on that's built entirely in the U.S. Every part of the space program is done here by U.S. workers, and that's a huge plus to the economy. But this latest thing that came out, it was an article that came from one of the NASA centers, was talking about some of the things we don't think about as much, like radiation-proof microprocessors, which are very important in the military for obvious reasons. You want to be able to fight in a radiation-rich environment. So that was kind of a big deal. They're expensive, but they're incredibly robust, and it's something that some of the foreign militaries are still trying to replicate.
Mm-hmm.
The modern artificial limbs that people have that have artificial muscles in them and these incredibly delicate sensors that allow you to be able to actually use the fingertips in a meaningful way to grasp things, the proper pressure and all that, and these really robust joints that are in them are an outgrowth of the arm development for various parts of the space program. One that I hadn't thought of was anti-scratch lenses on glasses.
Oh.
Originally came from wanting to make sure that the helmets didn't get scuffed up when you're on the moon, right? Because that's very sharp dust. It hasn't been abraded by any weather, so it's incredibly sharp. So that was something they spent millions and millions of dollars developing. Flame-resistant suits, like what race car drivers wear, came directly from spacesuits when they realized they had a flammability problem in the 1960s due to that Apollo 1 accident. So they learned very quickly how to flame-proof those. And that was a kind of a crash program that resulted in a lot of benefits. And finally, another one I had thought about was the Dustbuster, is, you know, a little portable battery-powered vacuum cleaner. Yeah. Was the spinoff from what they had put in the lunar module so that those guys could vacuum up when they got back, because the whole interior was coated with moon dust, which is very fine and, as I said, very abrasive. You don't want to breathe it because it can cause cancers and so forth ultimately. So that was yet another one. So I just thought it was a cute story because it reminds us of how much of our life is kind of saturated by things that have come not directly from space, but because we went to space,
yeah,
these developments.
You mentioned moon dust. What about moon rocks? Where can people see them?
Here in a lot of museums, especially this year, there was a lot of requests, and NASA sends them out under, you know, fairly strict security and shipping regimens. And I know there's one up in Seattle. There's one in an L.A. museum. Most of the major science museums that I've been to have at least a small one, and they're usually encased in a lucite pyramid, so you can see them. And they're kind of unremarkable looking. They look like a chunk of kind of sparkly charcoal. But I could probably dig up a list and send it to you to put up later, a link, if you want to.
Yeah. I was wondering if we had any here in Chicago, because we have, you know, we've got the Field Museum and the Museum of Science and Industry. And my guess would be that the Museum of Science and Industry would be the one that would might have.
I would think so, yeah, yeah. But we'd have to check to make sure.
Yeah. Okay, we got a text here, and this is you know, we talk about this all the time, Rod, every time you're on. Greg says, a friend of mine told me that the Earth will be hit by an asteroid in October. What do you know about that?
Well, they'd certainly be sounding the alarm bells if that was true. Now, if it's a small asteroid, I don't know the particular story he's talking about.
Yeah.
There are small ones that make grazing passes every now and then. But, you know, when people start getting worried about this is any time it's inside the orbit of the moon, which is 240,000 miles away on the average. So that's usually what those stories are about. If a decent-sized rock was coming to the Earth and people knew about it, the story got out, as you know, better than I, because you do news all the time, this would be a huge headline, and we'd be, you know, seeing suggestions about, okay, we've got to get a program going right now, and we better have the Russians send some of their nukes up, because they're ready to go, because they've been working on that, because that's a mission they want to try to do, is nuke an asteroid and see what happens, and so forth. So, no, we're not going to get hit by a large asteroid,
yeah,
anytime soon, because if we knew that, we'd know it, and we'd be very, very concerned, and actually doing something about it, which would be refreshing.
Yeah. But asteroids pass by us. They whiz by us pretty regularly, correct?
Yeah, all the time. And it's kind of a shooting gallery out there, which is one reason that there's been this increased emphasis since the Obama administration increased funding for looking for these things by a factor of 10 back in the about 2010, 2011. And the problem is, you know, you can only catch so many of them from the ground because they're dark and they're far away and they're small. So they've been trying to get orbital telescopes funded whose specific role is to look for the slightest indication out there in various methods so that you can spot these things far enough in advance. Because if you can reach them when they're way out there, you remember your basic trig, you know, you have a very small deflection when it's far away and it's not going to hit the Earth. But if you wait till it's closer, you're probably not going to be able to do it because you won't be able to have enough motive force to push it out of the way.
Oh, right.
So detection is the first big part of it, and then deflection is the second part. And we've talked before about the DART mission, the double asteroid redirect test that's going up, I think, in 2023 or 24, depending on when it can get a launch slot. And it's a kinetic impactor. It's a spacecraft that's going to go out to a small asteroid that has a very much smaller moon orbiting around it. Asteroids, some of them actually have their own little moons. And it's going to slam into that smaller moon. I think it's about 50 or 80 feet across, just to see if we can actually successfully do this deflection. And if it's enough to actually make a difference, and then if that works, we have to start engineering bigger and bigger units to be able to take out some of the big ones.
Yeah. All right. Okay. And another story that you sent to us that you wanted to talk about, goodbye International Space Station.
So we've known that this thing would have a limited life since we started planning it. So it became operational in 2000. It's 19 years old now in terms of how long people have been living in it. It's getting old, right? So we keep changing out parts of it, but it's very labor intensive. Most of the components have to be done from the outside. They involve these long spacewalks that are expensive and hard to do. And at this point, the astronauts on the crews are spending upwards of 50% of their time doing maintenance and upkeep and rejuvenation for this thing. So it's getting tired, and it's expensive. It's about $3 to $3.5 billion a year of NASA's money that it takes to run the Hoof, and then some more from the international partners. So there's been a lot of grousing about, you know, how long are we going to keep this thing? Originally, we were talking 2024. Then Congress got kind of bent about it and said, look, we've already paid for this thing. Let's keep using it. So they upped that to 2028. But with this renewed focus for NASA on returning to the moon, they want to try and offset some of these expenses. So they've looked at two things. They finally, after years of people asking, they're going to let tourists go up there. I think we talked about that last time. It'll only be a handful of them a year. You can stay for 30 days, but it's going to cost you about $50 to $60 million for the seat to get up there. And that just goes to SpaceX or whoever's flying you up. And then about $35,000 a day goes to NASA. So it's not going to add up to much. So I wouldn't call it a stunt, but it's certainly not going to be a big deal changer. What may be a deal changer, and what NASA's been looking at for a number of years now, is trying to increasingly privatize the station. There's a lot of medical research and material science that you can do up there that you can't do on the Earth. One example is there's a type of optical fiber that's like, I don't know, 50 or 100 times more efficient than what we can make on Earth that can only be made in zero-G. So they're looking at trying to partner with corporations to offset or take on a percentage or perhaps most of the cost of running the thing. The problem is it's really not optimized for manufacturing, so it's hard to say whether it would be cheaper to actually repurpose the space station as a corporate sort of endeavor or to just build something that's purpose-made to do what they're trying to do. Mm. So it doesn't even have people on it, probably. So it's an ongoing conversation, but at a certain point, we've got to just face up to, look, this thing's old. It's lived its life. The Russians want their, they put up the first module, which is the power and propulsion module that powers the station and pushes it out of the way when something's coming that they need to avoid. The Russians want it back. You know, they want to use it for other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they want to be able to do that by the early to mid-2020s. So there's a whole bunch of parties pulling in different directions that are trying to figure out what the fate of this thing should be.
Yeah. Because I'm talking about the cost. Is there a waiting list for people who want to go out there? I mean, we're talking about people who have a lot of money.
Yeah, there's been a handful. You know, starting in, I think, 1998. Actually, there was a couple of people who went up to the Russian Mir station because the Russians, you know, they're happy to sell you a seat. They don't care.
Yeah.
NASA's complaint was always that, you know, these people are going to get in the way and they're not astronauts. They don't know what they're doing. They're going to have to be trained. So
yeah,
there's an opportunity for private companies to do that as well, to train these people to do that. So they'll be given some basic tasks to do. But it's a rich man's game, rich person's game. And it's something that is going to happen in very, very small numbers. That said, there are a number of companies working on commercial space stations that would be entirely resort oriented. So you'd be able to go up and spend, you know, a weekend up there, your honeymoon, or a month, or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
They're generally, some of them are rigid. A bunch of them are so-called inflatables or expandables, like we've seen tested on the ISS. And they work really well. You know, they're basically like a big balloon up there that you can go inside of, and it's got windows and accommodations and all that. They haven't flown those yet with people in them. They just tested them on the space station. So there's a budding industry there, but it's a long ways off, at least 5, 6, 8 years probably.
But people have already, like, signed up.
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah. I mean, there's been a long waiting list for a long time. It's just NASA said no. So people would go to the Russians. The Russians would say, okay, you know, you can go visit our part of it. And they've done that a number of times, and it's been fairly successful. There haven't been any major mishaps. It's just something that NASA really dragged their feet on. Then they finally said, well, okay, but I personally can't see how the math works out, because when you're talking $3 to $3.5 billion a year of expenses, it's going to take a lot of tourists to go up there and make you any kind of revenue that's going to put a dent in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's just crazy. All right. Hey, Rod, hang on for a second, okay?
Sure.
All right. When we come back, I want to talk about you when you were working in the entertainment world there, working on TV and stuff like that. I want to. We haven't really.
Sure.
We've only touched on that, and I want to dive into it a little bit more after we break. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Rod Pyle is with us, a great author and great guy, and you can check out pylebooks.com. And he was in the entertainment world for a while, working on sci-fi TV shows and movies and things. We're going to get some stories from that right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Triple Play Thursday is starting a little bit late this morning, but we'll get to it. And that, if you want to jump in for your requests, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Kevin Powell is going to join us after 3 o'clock to talk sports. And there you go. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Ken Smith in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, hanging out with us is Rod Pyle, space expert, author. We were talking about the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and a bunch of other space stories. And Rod, welcome back.
Thanks. I want to mention before I forget, if you don't mind, the Apollo book has been on sale for a while on Amazon. So it's, instead of $30, it's $15. I have no idea why they did that, but that's good for us, right?
Well, wow. I mean, considering how great the book is, that's a bargain, man.
Yeah, and free shipping. So
wow! All right, go to Amazon. It's got the Apollo book. Rod Pyle's Apollo book is on sale for half price, $15. And trust me, I've got the book. It's worth a lot more than $15.
And also, BarnesandNoble.com has it as well. I should mention.
Very cool. All right. Okay. We have a very strange text here, Rod.
It is.
We are around the full moon, so sometimes. You know, the phone calls and the texts get a little weird, as you're probably aware. Hi, my name is Danny. My buddy told me that if you've ever smoked a menthol cigarette, you cannot go to space because as soon as you leave the atmosphere, your lungs will crystallize. Is that true or what?
I never heard that, but, you know, given the rate of smoking that was going on with those test pilots back in the early years from Mercury to Apollo, I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
Most of them quit, but I remember reading there was an article where they interviewed a bunch of them about their smoking habits, and most of them had. Some of them smoked pipes. Most of them smoked cigars, though they didn't inhale, but you still get secondhand.
Yeah.
And then a lot of them were cigarette smokers, and they usually quit by the time they're midway through the program because they just knew it was a good idea.
Yeah.
But never heard that about menthol. That's a new one by me.
All right. Well, maybe I think your
buddy. Thanks for trying, man.
I think your buddy might have not. I told you a lie, Danny. I'm not sure. So, all right, Rod, you know, you worked in the entertainment industry for a while working on TV. What are some of the things that you worked on?
I worked on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, very briefly on TNG, but just was kind of a day helper. And then I worked on Deep Space Nine for 3 seasons. Always got hired. I was like the last guy on, and they had always shot the credit roll by then, so I don't think I ever actually got in a credit roll.
Oh, no.
I was, it doesn't matter. I mean, they don't pay any more for that.
Right.
But I was working in the effects department, so we had a shop down the street from the main lot because we were non-union, so we rarely went on the lot unless it was to, you know, help supervise something on the set, which was mostly done by other people.
Yeah.
So it was this big metal shed down the street. And I had a desk underneath this old rusty staircase, so every time somebody went tromping up the steps, rust flakes would fall down on my work, and I'd have to kind of brush everything off to get started again.
Jeez.
But we had this huge set of motion control rigs there, because this was in the days of models and miniatures.
Yeah.
So you had these big rigs that you had the camera on. You've probably seen them. So the model's stationary, and the camera's moving, and it's doing the flybys, a frame at a time. And you do 8 or 9 or 12 of those, and then you'd go in the digital editing bay at great expense in those days. I think it was about $1,000 or $2,000 an hour. And
Jeez.
You'd composite these things together. So you'd have the main lighting pass, the deflector dish pass, and the pass for the lights, the portholes, whether they were fiber optic or sometimes they were a reflective material. And you'd put these things together. And these guys were just masters of this. So my job was to help build. We built cardboard ship models to do simulated passes to plan while the other ones, the real models, were tied up because those miniatures were anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000. They were expensive.
Mm.
So, you know, they can only kind of work on one rig at a time. So I'd build those mock-ups, and then I'd repair the models when they got broken and clean them up and so forth. And then we had a book of standard Federation colors so you knew how to go in and dial in all the right colors everything.
Right.
It was really labor intensive, and you know the upside was the work was beautiful when it was done. The downside was, as we've talked about before, you got a lot of shots of Sisko bouncing in his chair saying fire phasers, deflectors at half, and all that. When you really want to be seeing the big battle scenes, but they're expensive to do. I think the most fun part once was, and we did a bunch of different stuff, but one of the really cool things was we had a big battle scene. We needed a bunch of ships in the distance. And, you know, normally you just keep you do a couple of shots of the miniature from different angles and then just keep compositing it in, but that's expensive.
Yeah.
So they sent me down to the Hallmark store and I bought out their supply of Star Trek ornaments and we just hung them up in the background and said, okay, there they are. They're not moving much, but there they are. So I worked on those shows and then I worked on a Joe Dante pilot for a series that never went into production called The Osiris Chronicles. I think it was later renamed Warlord Battle for the Galaxy or something. And it had some kind of B talent in it for the most part. Rod Taylor was in it. He was the one A-list star.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was a very big, very expensive show, but I think I was the fourth visual effects supervisor on it. So I actually got promoted while I was working on it, but it was just this long, endless, you know, kind of a goofy story. It was Joe Dante, so it was very comic book, and he does some things very well. Space opera isn't one of them. And it did get seen, and it went on a VHS, but disappeared pretty quickly. So that was kind of forgettable, but it was fun to work on.
Yeah,
and
I would imagine.
Finally,
yeah, go ahead.
When they were doing the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, I set up a little effects shop with a guy I'd worked with on Trek and Gary Hutzel, and we spent, I don't know, probably a year doing the early work. So they call it pre-visualization. It's like, what's the ship going to look like? How's it going to move? How's it going to fire? How are the Vipers going to fly? What are their weapons going to look like? And so on. I actually even wrote a little bit because they asked for some script pages to contextualize these shots. So we worked on that for about a year, and then the whole thing went up to Vancouver, and I stayed in L.A., so that was the end of that. But it was a blast to work on. I think the weirdest thing I remember was Gary, my partner, coming back from a meeting he had with the writers, and they were trying to figure out what the new Galactica should look like. And it ended up kind of looking like the old one, but at one point they were really casting around, and he came back shaking his head. I said, what happened this time? And he said, they want me to make it look like a Frank Lloyd Wright building. I said, really? I thought, actually, that could be kind of cool, but I don't think so. And it was CGI, so we could do whatever we wanted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Time. But,
yeah.
But this was in the day, you know, this is about 2000, so you had to shoot or you had to put these scenes together and then send them out to a render farm. I think we were using one in Arkansas, where they had a couple thousand PCs all wired up.
Yeah.
And they'd send you back a frame at the end of the day, you know. So it was pretty grueling at
the
time.
Wow. What did you overall, did you enjoy the experience of working on those things?
I did. You know, it was really, Trek was the main thing because it had just been a lifelong ambition to be involved with it somehow.
Yeah.
And this guy who brought me in, actually, I had hired him in TV commercials in his first gig in California. And he worked for me there for a few years, and then he got onto the show as an effects guy. And I kept begging him. I said, get me in there. He said, I can't. We're not hiring. We're not this. And we need that. And finally, after a few years, he was able to get me on. So it was a great experience.
Yeah.
And I left it when we stopped using the physical miniatures because it just wasn't as much fun.
Yeah.
You know, Galactica was different because we were sort of starting at the beginning from scratch. But on Trek, I really missed the miniatures, so that was when I drifted off and started making documentaries. But I sure enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's fun, man. Okay, Rod, always a pleasure, and have a great time on Saturday with your celebration and your show and all that stuff.
Thank you much, and you stay safe and indoors.
Okay,
pal.
Buddy, I'm gonna. All right, see you, Rod.
Okay.
All right.
Take care,
Rod Pyle. He'll join us again next month. Always a lot of fun to have him on. All right, we're gonna break. We got the news coming up right after this.
A lovely day.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple A Thursday. Get those requests in. Okay. Well, yeah. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Okay, joining us right now, I mean, you know who it is because you heard Bill Withers. And when you hear Bill Withers, it means only one thing. Our good friend Kevin Powell is about to join us. Kevin does sports here on WGN on the Rokan Show afternoons. You can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720, kpowell720. And you check out his podcast at Powell at the Park right here at WGNradio.com. Let's get Kevin on the show. Kev, how are you, man?
Nick, I watched a movie last night. You may have heard of it. I think it's recently released. All the kids are talking about it. You can find it on Netflix and on demand. It goes by the name of Jaws. I'm not sure if you've seen the movie, but yeah, it was spectacular. I watched it last night, and I really enjoyed it.
Had you never seen Jaws before, Kevin?
Only 1,000 times.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I watched it last night, so I figured since I'm talking to Nick, I might as well bring it up.
Oh,
it is my
all-time
favorite.
It's one of the greatest movies of all time. All right. Well, how you been otherwise? You been busy?
I've been busy, but the good kind of busy, right? Just having fun doing radio with Ro and Anna in the afternoon and covering baseball, which has been no shortage of storylines in the Chicago baseball scene this summer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's start with the Cubs.
Yeah.
So Darvish got his first win.
First win at Wrigley with the Cubs. It's felt like forever since he even has recorded a win. I think it was 13 straight outings since he actually recorded a victory. You know, I think these last two starts have kind of given you a glimpse of what the Cubs had hoped they had gotten when they signed him for a $126 million contract. And that was sort of the confident ace-type stuff where, look, Darvish strikes out a ton of guys. He's one of the top strikeout guys in all of baseball, and he's looked a little hesitant, especially at Wrigley, where he's felt the pressure. You know, last year was a complete disaster, so I think he kind of put that pressure on himself. You know, he's a smart guy. He's a calculated guy. Takes pride in his profession and all those things, but hadn't really been able to put it all together. And now back-to-back quality starts for Darvish, I think that's a sign of hope for Cub fans and the Cubs as a whole, because it's really just been an up-and-down season for Darvish.
Yeah.
And the past, you know, it's 12 innings now of scoreless baseball for Darvish, and he's striking guys out, and he looks confident. We saw something we haven't seen from Darvish, which was a ton of emotion on the mound. He struck out a guy at the end of the sixth inning. You know, he's pounding his mitt. He's clenching his fist, he's pumped up, and we really haven't seen that from Darvish, so maybe he's kind of settling in a little bit.
Yeah. You know, it's so frustrating because I never thought, I mean, I was like, are the Cubs ever going to beat the Reds? It's just so frustrating.
You know, it's interesting because, well, that's their first series win over them in four tries this year, which
wow.
is crazy to think, but then if you kind of look at the record and kind of look at the division of the way it's played out, you know, going into this division, series, I should say, Cubs were in first and the Reds were in last, but it was 6.5 games separating them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that shows you how tough the Central is, and it shows you how deep it is. I realize they, you know, the Cubs have the third best record in the National League, and maybe not as top heavy as some of these other divisions, but top to bottom, you know, the Reds are a tough team.
Yeah.
Those are one of those teams you really don't want to play. You see, okay, they're in last place, but no, they're a couple guys away from being a really, really good team.
Yeah, no question about it. Let me tell you who I find the most annoying on the Reds.
I'm going to guess Yasiel Puig.
No. I'm not crazy about him. It's Dietrich.
Okay.
Guy makes me nuts. The play the game before last, where he clearly didn't go for the ball and he went for interference on Rizzo, and Rizzo got called interference. I wanted to punch him in the face, and the guy. the guy cheaply gets on a lot by just putting his elbow over the plate to get hit by a pitch, and the guy's been hit by a pitch. I know Rizzo hogs the plate. You know, he's on top of the plate, but he doesn't try to get hit. He likes to be close. But this guy clearly, like, moves in when the ball comes in. The guy drives me nuts.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone. I know I saw some stuff on Twitter as well. That's the type of team they are, you know? It's like the Nats that won't go away. You kind of swat at them, and they keep coming back.
Yeah.
So, no, I hear you. They're a team that's kind of frustrating. You just keep kind of saying to yourself, well, they're a last-place team, but they don't go away. It's a team you don't want to see, for
now,
sure.
Now, that play with Rizzo, I was infuriated. I was just infuriated. He didn't even attempt to pretend that he was going for the ball.
Right.
Made me so mad.
Joe Maddon would agree with you for sure, because Joe Maddon put on a spectacle. That's how you argue with an ump if you're a manager.
Yeah,
Joe Maddon did it right, so I hear you, man.
All right. What about Cole Hamels? What are we going here? He's coming back.
Yeah, looking like early August. Doesn't sound like they're going to really ease him. Well, I shouldn't say they're not going to ease him back, but it sounds like they want him back as soon as possible, obviously, because Cole Hamels has kind of resurrected his career since he came with the Cubs straight up for by the Cubs last year. He's pitched like the Cole Hamels we've become used to seeing, and looking like in early August, he's probably a week away from really ramping stuff up. He had a bullpen session, probably have one minor league stint down in Iowa, and then he's good to go. So we may see one more start from Alec Mills, who actually looked pretty good the other night.
Yeah, he did.
He hit four guys.
He did, and he had a shaky first, but he got it together, you know, after that.
He did. Yeah, I mean, all things considered, that was his first start in the big league since last August. So, all things considered, big stage, night game at Wrigley, he had a rocky first inning. But, you know, he's got really, really good stuff. I think if he kind of keeps it together and figures it out, he's got a shot at being a big league pitcher for a while. He's got some really good stuff. So I think for now, though, obviously the Cubs in the playoff hunt, they got to go with the veteran type guy, obviously. But it doesn't sound like Hamels is too far off. I think these next couple weeks really will determine how aggressive Theo is at the trade deadline. I'm not exactly sure who they're going to trade or who they would deal to get someone. And I don't know if Theo would be willing to deal somebody off the big league roster. I mean, I know they gave up Mike Montgomery, but would they give up a positional player? I'm not so sure, but yeah. I think a lot of it depends on where they're at in standings. And, Theo mentioned it. He goes, look, we're gonna see the separation we have with the rest of the division. That's going to determine a lot. So I think these next couple weeks with the deadline just a couple weeks away, I think that really determines how aggressive the Cubs do get at the trade deadline.
Yeah, well, Hamels was hot before he got hurt, man. I mean,
he was amazing. Yeah. I mean, he had the ERA just over one over his last six starts or so before he got hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a guy they're going to need for sure. He's a veteran guy. And as I said, he's been outstanding since they traded for him.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the Mai Tai guy. who, by the way, appeared on with Mark Kermit earlier
yeah.
This evening, or I should say last night. There are two camps by this, like people who are like, why would an adult take a ball away from a kid and all that other stuff? I was listening to part of the interview that Mark did with him. And he seems like a nice guy. I'm one of these people who are like, if you get a ball, give it to a kid. That's sort of where I stand.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. It's one of those things that's it's interesting to see how aggressive people are with that. And especially the reaction on social media, because you see a guy go for a ball and people were just going after this guy on social media. He's a bad guy. He's horrible.
Yeah.
But it's like the overreaction we see on social media time and time again, whatever it may be. I remember this time last year, there was a guy who got the foul ball, or the ball was tossed to a kid in like the front row, and the kid yeah. dropped it, and some guy grabbed it and handed it to the woman next to him, and everybody just went after this guy. He's a horrible guy. And then the whole story comes out.
Yeah.
Okay, the kid had already got two balls.
Right.
That guy had been getting balls for everybody the whole game and handing them out to everyone around him. Then there's more to the story. Now, this guy has doubled down. He's like, no, that's... I'm not giving the ball to the kid. Look, it is a walk-off homer. It's a Kyle Schwarber walk-off homer.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what. And Carm agrees with him. You know what I mean? Like Carm was, Carm's on his side, and he's
I would give the ball to the kid, but like at the same time, it's like, where do you draw the line? Where do you say, okay, you have to give the ball to the kid, you don't have to give the ball to the kid?
It's amazing how this guy is everywhere. And he goes to like all the games. I mean, he's everybody knows everybody knows who the guy is. Carm asked him how many jerseys he's got that say Mai Tai guy on them. He says seven, one for each day.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, that's a special fella. The way he got that name is pretty interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, for people who didn't hear it this morning, I'm sure it'll be available on podcast. Who didn't hear it last night, it'll be available on podcast with the Mai Tai guy. But he's everywhere now, man. He's almost like the dude who caught the alligator, who's
I had a chance to meet him, by the way.
Oh, did you?
He came in the studio with Roe and Anna yesterday afternoon.
Yeah.
And could not have been a nicer guy.
Yeah.
I mean, could not have been a nicer guy. He loves Chicago. And, I know it's so funny to me how that story has kind of evolved, because it is such a small town story.
Yeah.
Like, we've got a gator in the lagoon and everyone's railing around it while we're in like the third biggest city in the country.
I'm wearing a Gator Watch t-shirt, a Chicago Gator t-shirt. My parents got it made for me.
It was such a relief, though. I loved the story because I'm like, you know what? With all the crazy stuff in the world, let's just rally around a gator.
Absolutely.
And trying to catch. Who cares? Let's
absolutely.
Have fun with it.
And the other thing, really, really quickly, because we're going to break here, is that I love the one picture of Chance the snapper that everybody saw. He looked so happy, like the picture I'm talking about, where they're
with the little bow tie.
Yeah, and he's got a big like.
Looking dapper.
Yeah, absolutely. All right.
He was ready for the moment.
Yep, you got it. Kev, hang on.
All right, man.
Kevin Powell is here. You can hear him doing sports right here on WGN on the Rokan Show, afternoons, weekday afternoons. Follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. All right, we'll take a break. We got more sports to talk about right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran is out. It's Justin Kaufman. Justin Kaufman is filling in for Steve Cochran this morning, so stay tuned for that. Right now, we are talking with our good buddy Kevin Powell. Always a great time to talk to him. He works here at WGN, does sports for the Rokan Show. And you can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. And we have him on, you know, usually once a month to talk sports. And Kev, welcome back, buddy.
Nick, thanks for having me. As always, appreciate it.
You got it. All right, let's talk Sox. Boy, they're on a rough, they're having a rough patch. I mean, they were a pretty hot team before the All-Star break, but it's been a nightmare since.
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster of a season. I mean, they end the first half on a high note, beating the Cubs on that Sunday afternoon on the South Side.
Yeah.
They go into the break, they have three All-Stars, and now they've lost six straight losses.
Yeah.
It's probably the worst six game stretch they've had all season.
Yeah.
Now, I realize how frustrating it can be for Sox fans, but it's so easy to get on this high when they're playing well and, you know, they win 8 of 11 or whatever it was. And then they kind of hit this screeching halt. Look, it's still the rebuild. They're not quite there yet. This is what happens when you have an inexperienced team. This is what happens when you don't have the depth of a championship team, of a playoff caliber team. That's not me knocking them. It's just the reality of the situation. They're going to go through stretches like this. They are so close, and they've shown glimpses of it this year, which I think should make a lot of Sox fans excited. But then, of course, it does become very frustrating when they do go on these six-game stretches like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to say, I'm not a fan of interleague play. I'm an old dude. I'm one of these
none
guys.
None of it at all? You don't want
no,
any of it?
No. I think the only time that the American League and the National League team should see each other is in the World Series. That's just me. I've never liked the interleague play, and I'm particularly not fan of the Cubs and the Sox games. But I got to say, I watched that two game series, and I got to say that, you know, I don't watch a lot of White Sox games because I'm a Cub fan. But they're a fun team to watch. The White Sox are a fun team to watch, man.
Yeah, they are too, because it's a glimpse into the future. I mean, unfortunately, they have the injuries now with Yoel Jimenez. He's back on the 10-day injury list. He hurt his elbow chasing out a fly ball, ran into Charlie Tilson. Tim Anderson's on the injury list. They've kind of been snake bitten over the past couple of years. Michael Kopech had the injury, Carlos Rodon. But with all that being said, there are still so many things you can look at and say those are huge gains. I mean, you look at Yoan Moncada, who was the top prospect in the world, had a really bad year last season. Now he's having a huge year as he moved to third base. You can look at, again, Lucas Giolito. There's a lot of guys on this team. And then you look down to the farm system, the Luis Roberts and the Nick Madrigals, and it gives you so much hope. So,
Look,
they're at an 11-game improvement from this time last year.
Yeah.
They didn't have the amount of wins they had until August, as they do right now. So, like I said, kind of a glimpse into the future, and they really have been a fun team. And before this little stretch here, they were one of the more exciting teams in all of baseball.
Oh,
really,
no question about it. They were a hot team, man. Before the break, it was crazy. Now, how are these guys? There was an article in the Trib about how the White Sox are handling these losses.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, again, like I said, it's kind of part of the rebuild is learning how to lose and get over it, and learning how to win. I'm interested to see when they come home because they've been on the road since the All-Star break. You know, that's also not easy. I mean, you go from the break into your season-long 10-game road trip. I mean, and they've never played well in Oakland. And then they go down to Kansas City. It just felt strange. It just didn't feel right for a team that entered the break so hot. But that's baseball. You got to kind of figure it out, right? So, but, you know, this team, this clubhouse is tight. I think a lot of relationships are being built with a lot of these young guys. That's what you want when you're rebuilding. I expect them to bounce back. They've shown they can bounce back from rough stretches. But I'm really interested to see the clubhouse when they get back in town in a week or so.
Yeah. Okay, great. So that's some Sox stuff. And, again, you can hear all the Sox games right here on the Flagship Station of WGN. So there you go. Hey, let's talk real quick about Blackhawks development camp. What are we looking at here? Who are the hot players to watch?
You know, I think Kirby Dach's the top one for me.
Yeah, you know what? By the way, Kevin, he looks like he's 11 years old.
I know.
Every time.
Well, a lot of these guys do. I mean, they're 18, 17, 18, 19 years old.
It's crazy, man. I've been a hockey, as you know, I've been a hockey fan my whole life. And as I get older, obviously the players get younger. But my God, I looked at Dach and I was like, "This guy is—he looks like he's 13."
I know. And you know, I had a chance to meet him. He's a big dude, though.
Yeah,
like he has that baby face.
Yeah.
But he's probably 6'2", 6'3", and he's built. And you're already hearing rave reviews about him from Stan Bowman, Jeremy Colleton, the way he handles the puck.
Yeah.
You know, sentiment of the future type stuff. So, you know, I wouldn't be completely surprised if he makes the pro team, or if we see him with the Blackhawks this year, despite being, what is he, 19 years old. So,
yeah.
To me, that's the most interesting component of all. There's been 6 trades and 2 signings over the past 32 days for the Blackhawks, so they've been very busy, and I think you're kind of seeing Bowman shape the team the way Colleton wants it. And you saw the team play well under Colleton down the stretch last year, so I'm pumped for the Blackhawks. I think they're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm really excited about this. I'm really excited about this season, and I like the young guys. I've seen these guys skate, and a lot of these guys look really good. And I'm very excited for the season to start. And again, you can hear all the Blackhawks games right here. And
that's right.
All right, little Bears talk before we go here. What is this deal that the NFL Players Union rejected? They wanted to propose an 18-game season as opposed to a 16-game season.
Yeah, well, that's been on the table for a while, or at least talked about in the football world. The idea, at least that was floated by the owners, just an initial conversation with the Players Association, an 18-game schedule, but players are limited to 16 games, meaning there you would have to pick, as a coach, as a front office, 2 games in which certain players don't play. Every player would have to sit 2 games in the 18-game schedule. Now, they said maybe they could make an exception for quarterbacks. To me, I hate it because I think it dumbs down your product. I mean, every time when you tune in the NFL, it's once a week, you expect to see the best against the best.
Exactly.
Right, you know, and then if you say, okay, well, am I watching? You say, well, who's sitting? Is their best receiver sitting? Is their best linebacker sitting? Is their best running back? It just dumbs down the product. I just don't like it. I think it cheapens the product. I think just eliminate the 2 preseason games, and maybe if you're going to do 18 games, you know, no exceptions, or maybe make it 17 games, whatever. But I understand both sides. There's a ton of revenue to be had by 2 more regular season games, but then you also got to talk about player health in such a physical game. So I see both sides. But I think the idea, that idea floated, where you would have to sit 2 games, somebody at some point, it doesn't work for me. I don't like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of football fans would agree.
It would stink to sit down on the couch on a Sunday and be like, oh, this guy's not playing.
It
lessens your product.
Yeah, exactly. And I think 16 games is perfect because it's a tight schedule and every game counts. You know what I mean? That's why football is such an intense sport. You know what I mean?
Every week matters in the NFL.
Absolutely. Robbie Gould, no way, right? He's with the 49ers.
Nah.
He's with the 49ers.
Yeah, 49ers got aggressive, gave him a 4-year contract, 2 years guaranteed. So, Robbie, you can give away all the hope of him reuniting with the Bears, at least for now, as a player. So, Robbie Gould staying with the 49ers, at least for the next couple seasons.
He's got a 4-year contract that's worth $19 million, and the first 2 years is fully guaranteed with 10.5. My God.
Yes. Second highest paid kicker in the NFL. Good for Robbie.
Good for him, man. Yeah.
I should have been a kicker in the NFL, Nick. It was either that or radio, and I went with this. So. I'm having fun, though.
You got it. All right, cool. And we're looking forward to the Bears season because last season was so fun, man. So exciting.
It was, yeah. And they report to camp next week. They've got this cool thing on the 21st down at Decatur. Of course, the Bears starting as the Decatur Staleys, and they're doing this whole 100-year celebration.
Awesome.
So.
Awesome.
Yeah, so a lot of cool things happening.
Very cool. All right, Kevin, always a pleasure, man. People can hear you every weekday doing the sports on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis. Follow you on Twitter at KPowell720 and check out the podcast, Powell at the Park podcast at WGNradio.com. Always a pleasure, my friend, and we'll talk to you soon.
You're the best. I'm going to go watch Jaws a second time tonight.
Thanks, all right, buddy. Take care. Kevin Powell, the always delightful Kevin Powell, who is just a great dude all the way around. Love working with this guy. And he's a big Jaws fan. Okay, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN. We're going to talk about movies with hilarious titles in other countries. You know how a movie title gets translated? Tom, there's also all the hilarious products and what they're called coming out of Japan. Some of those are always really funny too. So we'll have a little bit of fun with that. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. Triple Play Thursday is coming up as well. All right, take a break here on 720 WGN. All right. American woman. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio right here on WGN. Coming up tomorrow, I just want to mention this. Tomorrow on the show, which is Friday, we'll have all of our regular Friday features, Fly Jams Friday, Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies. That's all coming up. But we're very, very happy to have back on the show with us tomorrow. She's going to spend about 3 hours with us, the lovely Esmeralda Leon, who used to be, part of the show here. And so she's going to be with us, and we're very excited about that. So Esmeralda Leon will be here, and then we'll do all the regular Friday features as well. So that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. All right. So we're going to talk about, you know, how these weird translation issues that people have with products, how they get translated weirdly. So we've got some of these movies that have hilarious and titles in other countries. So I'm having some issues with my logging in to my email. I don't know what's going on, and I'm getting angry. I had to change my password, and I changed it, and it worked on my phone, but it didn't work on this other computer, and so I'm having some issues right now. So I'm a little frustrated. So all right, we'll have to figure it out. But all right, let's go here. So we got movies that have hilarious titles in other countries. So how about this one? This is The War of the Stars. Can you figure what that one is?
I don't know. Maybe it was that War and Peace, maybe?
The War of the Stars. That's the French title for Star Wars. In Spanish, it was The War of the Galaxies. Makes sense. The title isn't the only thing that got a major switch in translation. In Germany, the Millennium Falcon becomes the Speeding Falcon. In France, Han Solo was Yan Solo, and his Wookiee sidekick got the name Chico.
Like Chico and the Man?
Chico. And their ship, the Millennium Condor. The Force definitely wasn't with those translators, just like these other ones. So how about this? Knight of the Night. So that's K-N-I-G-H-T. Of the Night, N-I-G-H-T, Night of the Night. Kind of makes sense. In Spain, that's the title of The Dark Knight, the Night of the Night. You may have thought that the Batman movie got its title from its brooding protagonist in gloomy cityscapes, but in Spain, they were much more literal because so many scenes in the movie take place at night. Okay, how about this one? Can you guess what it is? Superpower Dare Die Team.
What?
Superpower Dare Die Team.
I could see that being maybe like the Avengers or something.
Superpower Dare Die Team would have been the Chinese title for the Ghostbusters reboot. Starring Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, and Leslie Jones, had it ever been released there. Guidelines in China forbid movies to, quote, promote cults or superstition. Though the country's censors said the official reason was that it wouldn't appeal to the Chinese audience. Hopefully that doesn't apply to the other other movies. Super Die... I don't even know. Where does that come from?
It's so weird.
Superpower Dare Die Team. So
because they're a team, they've got the
I guess the ghosts refer to die.
Yeah, they're die team.
Can we get the weather? Oh, okay, cool. Just want to make sure you got it. Superpower Dare Die Team.
Okay.
How about this? A very powerful whale runs to heaven. A very powerful whale runs to heaven. The beloved tearjerker Free Willy is known for its happy ending. The Chinese saw things a little bit differently, giving the movie the above title instead. Then again, Willie did jump, not run, to the metaphorical heaven of the open ocean. So they say that they're basically in the title are saying that the Free Willie is dead Willie. How about this one? He's a ghost. With an exclamation point at the end. He's a ghost. Oh, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable with this that this is the title of the movie. That's The Sixth Sense, which has one of the greatest twist endings of all time, according to this, unless you happen to live in China. So in China, the movie was called He's a Ghost.
I guess the real twist is, which one? Who's the ghost?
I guess. Although most audiences were stunned by the movie's revelation in the final minutes, Chinese viewers were already clued in by the title. Okay. Well, what do you guys think here? 312-981-7200. Have you ever seen some weird sort of translation for products and any of that kind of stuff? We have to take a break here for the weather, and then we'll come back with more. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center for today. Excessive heat warning and upper-level disturbance looks to trigger a band of thunderstorms that should move through the area before noon. And then hot, humid air in the afternoon. Heat indices between 102 and 108, mid-90s. No relief at night. Temperatures in the 80s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, continued dangerously hot and humid with no nighttime breaks and temps. 101 degrees it could get up to. Muggy overnight with temperatures in the 80s. And then on Saturday, the excessive heat warning continues. Clouds increase from the north. Slight chance of thunderstorms in the late afternoon. High temperatures about 100. Sunday, partly cloudy, cooler, not as humid. A thunderstorm was possible. High in the low 80s with an onshore breeze giving cooler temps at the lakefront. And then Monday, cooler, less humid. Canadian source high pressure pushes into the area. Afternoon highs in the upper 70s. Man, that sounds good. With cooler readings at the lakefront. Clear skies overnight, northeast winds. Current temperatures at O'Hare at 78 degrees, at Midway 79, and at the lakefront, 78 degrees. All right, let's take a quick break. We've got more titles that have been hilariously translated into another language, and we've got some corporate logos that we're going to talk about as well right here on 720 WGN. Sudden darkness, but I can see. No sugar tonight, no coffee, no sugar tonight. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. And who requested the Guess Who?
That's coming to us from listener Tom.
Tom. All right. Triple Play Guess Who right there. Hey, welcome back, everybody. It is a Thursday morning right here on 720 WGN. And we are talking about some really hilarious titles that have been translated to different countries from movies. All right, how about this one? This is the title of the movie. The Boy Drowned in the Chocolate Sauce. The Boy Drowned in the Chocolate Sauce. That's Denmark. In Denmark, that's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Very dark title, but kind of hilarious. While greedy Augustus Gloop does take a harrowing swim in a chocolate river, his fate isn't quite that grim. While many countries kept the original title of the Gene Wilder classic, others tweaked it to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is the actual title that is the novel of the novel. Portugal changed it to Charlie's Wonderful Story. And Spain picked A Fantasy World. That's pretty generic. Hey, you want to go see A Fantasy World? But I really like The Boy Drowned in the Chocolate Sauce. I think that's a great title for the movie. All right, how about this one? Die Hard Mega Hard. Die Hard Mega Hard. Let's face it, it was only a matter of time before Hollywood co-opts this Danish title. And it's for Die Hard with a Vengeance. So Die Hard Mega Hard is Die Hard with a Vengeance. And in Denmark, mega means huge, but it also signifies a million. So the Danes were so intense that it's Die Hard a million times hard.
Certainly gets the point across, I suppose.
I guess. Die Hard, Mega Hard. I wouldn't be surprised. Again, if they make another Die Hard movie, that sounds like a title that they might use, considering how stupid the titles of the last two were. What was it? Die Hard. Good Day to Die Hard.
Good Day to Die Hard. Live Free or Die Hard.
Live Free or Die Hard. Stupid.
Well, I mean, I think they should just start mining titles from other movies like Die Hard. This would be Die Hard 6. So Die Hard 6, The Good, The Bad, and The Hard.
Oh, please. God, there's five Die Hard movies, isn't there?
Yep, yep, yep.
Oh, man. Okay. This is the Japanese title for Leaving Las Vegas. You ready for the Japanese title of Leaving Las Vegas? The title... This is great. The title for Leaving Las Vegas in Japan is I'm Drunk and You're a Prostitute. Hey, honey, you want to go see I'm Drunk and You're a Prostitute? The Japanese get points for brutal honesty with this title for Leaving Las Vegas. Nicolas Cage won the Best Actor Oscar for his devastating performance, and his co-star Elizabeth Shue was riveting in her role in the acclaimed drama. Nonetheless, he was portraying a drunk, and she did play a prostitute. And the title also happens to paraphrase one of Cage's lines from the movie, in case you forgot. There you go. Okay. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Oh, no.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs in Israel is called It's Raining Falafel.
Yeah, that's actually that could be a restaurant.
That's great. Yeah, it's raining falafel. Israel, where meatballs are not a popular dish, clearly wanted to make Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs more appealing to its audience. So the Hebrew title swapped out the meatballs for falafel, a more recognizable food. In Philadelphia, the animated meatballs were not altered. So I guess people went, hey, wait a minute. That's not falafel. Those are meatballs.
It's meat.
Ike sent in a text that said the original title for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was Teeny Weenies. I wonder what that translated to. All right. Step Up. Oh, we all know Step Up. That's how we all discovered Channing Tatum. Step Up. In French is Sexy Dance. Sexy Dance.
Oh.
In the first Step Up movie, Channing Tatum and Jenna Dewan come from the opposite sides of the tracks, but they're able to bond through dance, and it's beautiful. Whoever titled the French version of it simply cut to the chase and called it Sexy Dance. That pretty much nails it. So were the sequels like Sexy Dance 2?
Sexy Dance 2, The Streets.
what was the subtitle of that one?
The Streets.
It
was Step Up 2, The Streets.
Oh, right, Step Up to the Streets. Right, yeah. Right.
But, of course, the numeral. So, Sexy Dance 2, The Streets.
The Streets. All right. How about this one? All right, how about this is Greece. What's the, in Argentina, Greece. The title of Greece in Argentina is Vaseline.
Ew.
Vaseline.
Ew.
Yep, Grease. Everyone loves Olivia Newton-John as Sandy during her epic transformation in the iconic musical from 1978. John Travolta as Danny is the one that she wants, even though he's a tough guy greaser. In 50s slang, which means you slick back your hair and you have a bad reputation, but for the translation in Argentina, it was simply Vaseline. Talk about something that was lost in translation. Okay. How about The Parent Trap? The Parent Trap, in German, The Parent Trap is A Twin Seldom Comes Alone. Sounds like a fantastic title for a family comedy. A Twin Seldom Comes Alone. This German designation for the reboot of The Parent Trap is quite literal. It was Lindsay Lohan's first starring turn. The 1961 original starred Hayley Mills. The story is about twin sisters raised apart by feuding parents who decide to reunite the family. The twins are played by a single actress in both film versions. That's why the German title writer decided to get philosophical with the title. If you're equally as much of a film buff, There you go. You probably know that. A twin seldom comes alone. All right, we got a few more of these titles, and we're going to talk about memorable corporate logos as well after we break for the news. Baby, get on board. Reaper wants to take y'all for a ride. His private train is leaving to slip you to the other side. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, Triple Play Thursday. We got one more Guess Who song to hear in just a little bit. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are going to talk about some of the most recognized brand logos of all time and what that means. That's coming up. But right now we've been going through this list of titles, movie titles that translate differently in different countries, and they're ridiculous. My favorite so far is "I'm drunk and you're a prostitute." That's leaving Las Vegas. That's my favorite. This one's good though. This one's good. This is in Russia. Silver Linings Playbook. Silver Linings Playbook is called "My Boyfriend Is a Psycho."
They do such literal translations of just. Of just the plot.
Yeah. Like... But the thing is, they're both a little crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. The point of Silver Linings Playbook is that they're... Look at what this just says. Oh. They're both a little crazy.
Yeah.
Russia. However, we can't blame the translators for changing this title, since the English phrase, "every cloud has a silver lining," doesn't really have a foreign equivalent. Other countries had to seek an alternate name for the film. French called the comedy "Happiness Therapy." Lithuania went with "The Story of the Optimists."
What is this?
And finally, since a playbook is an American football term, the United Kingdom dropped that part and just went with "silver linings."
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, this one you can probably figure out what this is. This movie. The actual title of this movie is. This is the translated title. And this is from France. It's called "The Teeth of the Sea."
Oh, the Jaws?
Yes.
The Teeth of the Sea.
Teeth of the Sea. The marketing of the blockbuster Jaws was brilliant for its minimalist simplicity. With one word, audiences got a taste of the horror to come. The visual of the iconic movie poster with a woman swimming above a massive open-mouthed shark gave the single word "Jaws" its power and impact. In France, the effect was a bit muted. "The Teeth of the Sea" sounds much less scary and a lot more confusing.
That makes sense, though.
We should call Powell back, K. Powell back, and tell him that his favorite movie is actually called "The Teeth of the Sea."
Yes.
All right. How about this? "Mom, I missed the plane."
Oh, is that Home Alone?
Home Alone, yes. That's in France, too. That's what it's called. Home Alone is called "Mom, I Missed the Plane." The French must have decided that every parent's worst nightmare, leaving a child behind, is actually the child's fault. That can be the only explanation for altering John Hughes' Home Alone to that title, "Mom, I Missed the Plane." That's right. Kevin missed the plane, and he brought all his Home Alone burglar mayhem stuff on himself.
Yeah. No, that sounds about right.
Yeah. All right. What about The Water Boy? What do you think the title of The Water Boy?
I don't know. Something to do with maybe a bay, like a swamp? Swamp Man?
No. This is in Thailand. This is what they call The Water Boy in Thailand. The title of The Water Boy in Thailand is "Dimwit Surges Forth." Dimwit Surges Forth. Adam Sandler comedies are not usually known for their inspirational overcoming the odds tales of high stakes struggle and survival, so it's not clear why The Water Boy was titled Dimwit Surges Forth in Thailand. However, the Dimwit's rinky dink team does surge forth in the end.
I mean, that could be the title of any Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah.
His Dimwit Surges Forth.
Yeah. All right. Airplane. Airplane. France, Peru, and Croatia, and Germany. Well, this is from Germany. This is the title from Germany for the movie Airplane. It's The Incredible Journey in a Crazy Plane.
They couldn't just call it the German word for airplane?
I guess not. The incredible Journey in a Crazy Plane. This was Germany's interpretation of the madcap comedy slash disaster movie spoof Airplane. Italy went literal, calling it... In Italy, the title is The Craziest Plane in the World. The Craziest Plane in the World. Several other countries, including Croatia, France, and Peru, also lengthens America's one-word title, some calling it, Is There a Pilot on This Plane? but the funniest title of all might be the working title used for the film during production, which is Kentucky Fried Airplane. Well, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's ZAZ, and ZAZ was responsible for the Kentucky Fried movie, which is a hilarious movie.
It's insane.
It's hilarious. I remember I saw that movie. I was a kid when that movie came out. Man, I became obsessed with it.
I saw that when I was way too young.
Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw it when it came out. I think it came out in 1976, 1975, maybe.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
My uncle thought it would be a good idea to show that to me on DVD.
Well, there's a lot of nudity in that movie. I mean, you got the whole, you know, the whole last scene where they're having sex on the couch and and the newsmen played by ZAZ are watching them. you've got Catholic high school girls in trouble.
And, what's... Rex something danger seeker.
Oh my god,
that is ridiculous.
Rex Kramer, because
Rex Kramer,
seeker. That's also Robert Hayes' name in Airplane.
Yeah,
is Rex Kramer. Yeah, danger seeker.
You can't.
Cleopatra Schwartz, and then the whole middle Bruce Lee thing, Fistful of Yen.
Yep.
That movie's genius, man. It's absolutely hilarious, and it really did pave the way. For Airplane, like that kind of humor was all over Kentucky Fried movie, and that was the movie that Kentucky Fried movie was how Landis got Animal House.
Mm-hmm.
They saw Kentucky Fried movie and they were like, "Get this guy to direct Animal House."
It's just joke after joke after joke.
That's all
like,
it is,
rapid
man.
Fire.
And there were a lot of those sort of weird short anthology comedies that came out. There was The Groove Tube. There was Tunnel Vision. Most of them were spoofs, you know, of television, like Groove Tube and Tunnel Vision. There was also Can I Do It Till I Need Glasses, which is a very early Robin Williams appearance in a movie. The Groove Tube, by the way, featured Chevy Chase.
Okay.
Chevy Chase was in the Groove Tube. Ken Shapiro was the guy who co-wrote that and directed it. But yeah, that was a thing. Like that kind of like short skits and satire and parody. That they made like three or four movies in the '70s that were like that.
Mm-hmm. And then even Monty Python's one of the first things they had in America was
Now for Something completely different,
which is just a recutting of all the sketches to be like that.
That was the first. You know, release of their movies. Obviously, the first real movie that they made was Holy Grail.
That was completely different. Was just the like a best of sketches sort of thing.
Yeah, yes, that's and Now for Something Completely Different. Yeah. So, still hilarious.
Still funny.
Yeah. What's with the Pat Benatar this week? What's going on?
Everybody's just in a Benatar mood,
man. Everybody's into the Pat Benatar this week, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, different people each time requesting a little Benatar.
Okay. Well, this is a triple play Thursday, so we're going to get to hear three Pat Benatar songs. Who requested Pat Benatar?
That's from Ike.
Ike. Yeah! All right. We are talking about... these weirdly translated movie titles and how they translate in different countries. I'm drunk and you're a prostitute.
I personally like the Free Willy one. What was that? A whale runs to heaven.
Yeah. All right. How about this? yeah. China. In China, the movie Nixon. This is pretty funny. Considering, you know, how historic his trip to himself. Nixon's trip to China was.
Right.
But in China, Nixon is called Big Liar. Anthony Hopkins gave an acclaimed performance as the disgraced president in the biopic Nixon, a drama that humanized the flawed American leader. Oliver Stone's three-hour epic intended to depict the complexity of Nixon's impact on history. In China, the movie was released with the title Big Liar. So why mince words? That's pretty funny. That is pretty funny. All right. Yeah, that's pretty good. Big Liar. Okay. All right, how about the Pixar film Inside Out. There are tons of different names for Inside Out. It says here the beloved Pixar film Inside Out told a complicated emotional tale to child and adult audiences alike. Which, by the way, Inside Out is absolutely one of my favorite Pixar movies, and I was a mess during that movie. I cried like a baby during Inside Out. Just ridiculous. I mean, you know, you cry at, like, you know, the majority of Pixar movies, you end up crying at some point.
Sure.
Inside Out, I lost it, though.
When
her imaginary friend.
Oh, yeah, Bing Bong.
Bing Bong, man.
Who is the voice? Who is his
Richard
voice?
Kind.
That's it, Richard yeah. Kind. So good.
Such great voice work in that. In that movie, so perfectly cast. I mean, Amy Poehler is so awesome in that movie. Yeah, no, that movie destroyed me, man.
And of course, Phyllis is sadness.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Lewis Black. Lewis Black as anger. So here's it's a complicated emotional tale. However, multiple countries struggled with a quick, clear title for the movie. In China, the movie is called The Great Team Inside the Head.
That's what I call my team of therapists.
Yeah, The Great Team Inside the Head. Or you can call that multiple bathroom attendants. Russia went with Jigsaw. Oh, that's an entirely different movie in this country. Vietnam chose The Puzzle Emotions.
Okay.
The Puzzle Emotions.
Okay.
But Thailand may have taken the day by dubbing it Fantastic Emotional Turmoil.
Something we can all relate
God,
to.
God, this stuff is funny, man. This is funny. All right, how about this? Due date in Slovenia.
And that's the Dude Galifianakis.
Zach Galifianakis and Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
It's a terrible movie.
Not very bad.
I'm always like, oh, is this supposed to get me in the theater from the director of Hangover? That's supposed to get me to go to the theater?
Yeah.
That's what they advertise. And that's how they advertise, what the hell was it, War Dogs?
Yeah, which is a very, very poorly made movie with people I really enjoy in it.
Yeah, Miles Teller, and Jonah Hill. Are the leads?
Yeah,
not a good movie. But again, they advertise it from the director they said from the director of the Hangover trilogy.
Why would they want to acknowledge 2 and 3?
Well, why would you acknowledge the first one?
I mean, you could at least get away with the first one was a runaway success.
Well, they all were. They all made. Well, the third one didn't make as much. The second one made a ton of money.
Yeah.
Anyway, due date is titled "Honey, Wait, I'm on My Way." To be fair, this is an accurate summation of the road trip buddy comedy, where Robert Downey Jr. must take a cross-country trip with Zach Galifianakis as his wacky travel companion, get home in time for the birth of his baby. Some other countries took the American route, working the pregnancy into the title. In Portugal, the film is titled A Childbirth Trip.
It's so weird to think of them making that movie with both Galifianakis and Downey Jr. coming straight off two of the hottest movies of their careers at that point.
What was...
Downey Jr. had just been in Iron Man in 2008, and then The Hangover came out in 2009.
Right. All right, A Child Trip Birth, and then the most hilarious of all, according to this, in Poland, the title of Due Date translates to Before the Water Goes.
Oh, jeez.
Okay. All right, speaking of Pixar, how about Up? Up in certain countries is known as Grandpa Carl's Flying House.
Very accurate.
Most countries kept the simplicity of the title of Pixar's Up. Argentina called Up an Adventure Up High. The Czech Republic chose To the Sky. Japan, however, not so much. They chose Grandpa Carl's Flying House, which might sound like a comically literal summation of the film. It actually somewhat is inaccurate. Yeah, the house does not fly. It's carried by balloons. But the cinema trivia doesn't end there. So there you go. All right, Grandpa, Grumpy Old Guy Carl's Flying House is another version of in Asia. So, all right. that is funny. That's funny. All right, let's take a break. And we're going to talk about some of the most recognized brand logos of all time. And which ones are for you guys? What are some of the brand logos that are completely recognizable? Some of the greatest corporate logos of all time. And we'll talk about that if you want to jump in at 312-981-7200. News is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Thursday, Triple A Thursday. Yeah, Triple A Thursday! And that's the second of three Pat Benatar songs that we're going to hear this morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We're going to be talking about some of the most recognized brand logos of all time. And let's see. Let's just go right to it. All right, how about Google?
Of course.
Ah. Google, millions of people see this logo on their computer screen every single day. This is the centerpiece of a website that handles over 100 billion visits per month, and it's got to look good. Google is known for being a fun company, and their colorful logo certainly reflects that. A law firm definitely couldn't pull off a font like that. I like when Google does the, you know, for anniversaries of things or birthdays of things, when they do little animated stuff.
Yeah.
They change the logo, you know, and they do that frequently. At least I think it's like once a week they do something like that.
At least.
And I know that during the World Cup.
Yeah.
Every day it was a different, you know, a different World Cup related logo.
Yeah.
So.
And they do so many interactive things. Like often if you click on it, especially if it's like, you know, Marie Curie's birthday.
Yeah.
They'll go and they'll tell you, all right, here's a little video usually animated about, hey, here's who Marie Curie is. And then once it's done, it takes you to
all the results. Yeah.
And it's really fun.
Yeah. I like Google. I use Google all the time.
Yeah.
And I think everybody. I mean, it's a verb now.
Yeah.
It's a verb.
Once, because I was lucky enough. I mean, obviously, I was born after Google was already invented. It had been invented in, what, the late 90s, I think, like 99, 2000.
Well, that's when it's really kicked in. I think before that. I think Google was around before that.
But when I became aware of what Google was, it changed my entire life. It really did.
Well, what about Ask Jeeves?
I did appreciate the little butler. I did like Jeeves.
It's just Ask now.
Yeah, ask.com.
There's also Bing.
Ah, dumb. Bing.
Dan Shigrew used Bing.
Why would he use Bing?
I don't know. He did.
Well, I use Bing sometimes because they have, like, a rewards thing. If you search enough, if you use it enough in a day, you get, like, a rewards point so you can exchange
for
gift cards.
Oh, is that
right?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, how about this logo, IBM? The 8-bar IBM logo was designed by legend Paul Rand to replace his pre-existing logo of the letters IBM bolded in black. The change was supposed to reflect the change of emphasis from stability to speed. Here's another one. Walmart. You got that little symbol. Is it supposed to be a sun?
Well, I remember it was a star. There used to be a star between Wall and Mart.
Okay.
And now it's like that weird little... I guess it looks like a sun.
It does. It looks like a sun thing on the other side of the Walmart. Yeah.
I want to know where the big smiley face went.
Yeah. Walmart is the defending champion of the Fortune 500 list and raked in over $450 billion in revenue in its last fiscal year. In 2008, the Walmart logo underwent reconstructive surgery. The star used to break the wall and the mart was removed. The logo was made more colorful. A lighter blue was used for the font, and a yellow spark was added to the right of the text. Oh, a spark. That's what it is. To make the text more appealing. Visa. Well, everybody knows that with the two... Oh, wait, that's MasterCard, is the two circles.
Yeah, it's the two circles.
Yeah, Visa, it's everywhere you want to be, so is the logo. The simple Visa emblem is constantly seen on TV, at restaurant windows, and on those little pieces of plastic we hate so much, yet bring with us everywhere. This logo was introduced in 2006 and gave a more modernized feel to its boxy blue and yellow predecessor. eBay. That's classic. eBay was named something else at first.
Yeah, it had a different website.
It was eBay something. Like, it was longer. Like, the original name of eBay was long. It was still eBay something. The online auction giant released a new logo in 2012, replacing the old logo that was used when the company started. At the time, it was called AuctionWeb. Changed its name to eBay in September of 1997. The new logo uses elements such as zigzag letters, known as a baseline shift, and fun colors to convey a sense of energy and dynamicity. And the overlapping letters also signify the great sense of community among eBay users.
I think it was originally, or at one point, it may have been called Echo Bay.
That might be it. That's it. That's it. It's Echo Bay. I knew it was a longer version of what it is now. So,
Originally the site, like, they wanted to change from AuctionWeb.
Yeah.
And they wanted to be Echo, they wanted to get EchoBay.com, but it was already taken by Echo Bay Mines, a gold mining company.
Right, right.
So it got shortened to eBay.
Right. That's the story of that. That's the story that I remember right there. 312-981-7200 is the phone number and text. We would love to hear from you. What are the most iconic logos, corporate logos, and recognized brand logos of all time? 312-981-7200. About FedEx. FedEx, the company that is formerly known as Federal Express, is perhaps the best example of an in-your-face subliminal advertising. If you look closely at the white space between the uppercase E and the X, you'll see an arrow. While the average consumer may not pick up on this at first, it gives a message of speedy service and delivery. FedEx is also clever with the coloration of its logo. The Fed portion is always purple, and the X changes colors based on the company's subdivision. It's gray. It's referring to the corporation. Orange is used in FedEx Express. Red is used in FedEx Freight. Blue in FedEx Kinko's. Yellow in FedEx Trade Networks. And green in FedEx Ground. A lot of thought process going into that. How about 3M? 3M, two simple characters in big red font. It doesn't get much more in your face than that. Despite looking like it took approximately 17 seconds to design, this logo has managed to become renowned in its own right since the 1978 debut. The official 3M emblem started as a circle containing the company's full name, which is Minnesota Mining Manufacturing Company, and headquarters were located, location wrapped around the diamond with the three words 3M Co. imprinted both vertically and horizontally. But it's undergone some multiple revisions since 1906, becoming simpler and simpler and simpler with each one, and now it's just 3M. Of course, Coca-Cola. That's legendary. By the way, you know, Tom, you were not around when New Coke was a thing.
I've heard it was a serious controversy.
Oh my God. Let me just explain something to you. This was 1985 when New Coke made its appearance, and I was working at the Jewels, and people were yelling at me about New Coke, about how bad it was. They were yelling at like me, and I'm like, look, I just put the stuff on the shelf. I don't work for the Coca-Cola Corporation. I did not make this idiotic decision to change the classic formula of one of the most successful beverages in the history of the world.
Potentially more successful than water.
I'm just a dude with an apron on putting cans on a shelf. Why don't you just leave me alone? But people were infuriated. And it was terrible. New Coke was terrible. It tasted almost like Pepsi. And
do you know what they did? They say what they did?
How they changed it?
Yeah, how did they change it?
Nah, they didn't really go into detail about it. But yeah. It was, I mean, it's one of the most beloved products of all time.
Sure.
And so some people, there are conspiracy theorists out there that think that it was done on purpose so that it once they brought Coke Classic back, when they brought Coca-Cola Classic back, that the sales would go through the roof. And they did.
So you're trying to tell me that...
There are people out there, there are Oliver Stones out there who think that New Coke was a corporate decision...
It was a false flag.
...to put that out there for a while and then bring Coca-Cola Classic back and sell, like, a ton of it. And that's exactly what happened. When New Coke was out and they got rid of the regular Coke, your Coke Classic, and the only Coke that was available was the New Coke... People seriously were losing their minds. I'm not kidding. Like I said, I was working at the Jewels at the time, and a day didn't go by when at least two or three people didn't go, why is this a new Coke? Why do you have any old Coke? And I'm like, no.
So they didn't even have, like, they just completely replaced all that old Coke.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. Well, now they really make a point on newer cans of Coke. I try not to drink too much, but it says original taste on every can to like remind you.
Well,
hey.
Now they've got so many flavored Cokes, you know, with the tall, thin, colored, you know, like
the weird diet.
Yeah, there's all kinds of weird fruity flavored Cokes now.
I will say the orange Coke is actually really good.
There's an orange vanilla.
Orange vanilla.
Yeah.
Very good.
But yeah, there's an end cap at my dad's Jewels where we shop as well at Irving and Narragansett. They just put in not too long ago, and it's just a Coke cooler that you can go to and grab a can of whatever, and it's just filled with all the weird flavors and cans. So, but I'm telling you, man, that new Coke thing was ridiculous. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
I like that conspiracy theory, though.
Well, but yeah, there are the people like, yeah, that was done on purpose, man.
Listen, I got a man on the inside.
Man, and they did this purposely so that they could boost the sales of Coca-Cola when Coca-Cola Classic came back. And then I don't know if the new Coke is still available, but.
Well, Stranger Things brought it back for like a promotional thing, but I don't know if that's the
they
real
kept it.
New Coke.
They kept it going, so like when they brought Coca-Cola Classic back, they kept New Coke.
You could still get New Coke.
Yes,
I don't know,
but yeah, but that's a logo. We're talking about corporate logos. That's a legendary logo. Mm-hmm. Is Coke and Coca-Cola. So, all right, we'll take a break here for some weather. Song is a jam. That's Pat Benatar wrapping up our Triple Play Thursday. That's from the movie The Legend of Billie Jean.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I got that title, right? With Helen Slater?
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Not a very good movie, but the song's great. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. At 6 o'clock, Justin Kaufman in for Steve Cochran. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Ken Smith in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We should say, I haven't said it all morning, we should say that that Vic is out. He's a little under the weather, so he was out this morning and he'll be out tomorrow. So we will not be doing a Vic's picks. We'll save that for when he comes back. But he's just out for a couple of days. He's feeling under the weather and decided to stay home. So he won't be on again tomorrow. So we're doing, corporate logos are the most memorable that we have here. 816 area code says, my logo story: in a world of so many logos for athletic apparel and media and social media companies, there is a quintessential logo that has stood the test of time for over 130 years, and that would be the zigzag rolling papers with the zigzag man. The story goes, in a battle in the 1850s, a French soldier was shot, but his life was saved when the bullet shattered his clay pipe. Being resourceful, he rolled a cigarette with a piece of paper. The Bronstein brothers of France invented the pack of disposable rolling papers. They used the likeness of the soldier with his hat, full beard, and cigarette. The folded connected papers view was, it looked like a consecutive Z. The Rolling Stones with their lips and tongue. Yeah, that's a pretty good logo right there. Jay says the K in Kmart stands for SS Kresge. Department store. Yeah, we talked about that when we were talking about origins of how things got their names.
Mm-hmm.
502 area code says, how about Kodak? Yeah, that's been that logo for a long time.
That's an awesome logo.
Yeah. 773 area code says Nike with the swoosh. Classic. Absolutely classic. 312, of course, McDonald's. 312 area code says McDonald's logo, the golden arches. Recognized worldwide. 708 area code says a Chevy bow tie. Carrie says the oldest trademarked logo is the Bass Beer Red Triangle. Wow, I didn't know that. For me, it's the Ford script logo that's never changed. The CEO of Coke, 262, says the CEO of Coke was asked about that conspiracy theory, and he said, we aren't that smart and not that stupid. Well, that certainly answers the question.
There it is.
All right, let's see. More corporate logos. How about the Olympics? As a sports enthusiast, I personally have a soft spot for the Olympics. Over 200 countries around the world putting aside their political and economical differences and setting forth their best athletes to challenge themselves and each other purely for the love of sports and competition. It just brings a tear to my eye. The rings are recognized around the world and have been represented the Olympics since 1912. The five interlocking circles represent the joining of five continents, the Americas, Asia, Africa, Europe, and Oceania, and the colors represent the flags of participating countries. Every country that participates participates flag includes red, blue, yellow, green, or black.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
How about Disney? Most people do not realize the full size of Walt Disney Company, a true conglomerate. Some of their subsidiaries include ABC, ESPN, Pixar, Marvel, the History Channel, and most recently Lucasfilm. The logo is the actual signature of Disney co-founder and animation legend Walt Disney. That's his actual signature.
Really?
Oh yeah.
How does he get the dot over the I is like not a dot, it's like its own little shape.
Yeah, I mean that was his signature.
That's so weird.
Yeah. 847 area code says, just curious, why do you call Jewel the Jewels? I get this question. I've been calling it the Jewels for years. It's a joke. As a longtime Jewel employee, this has always baffled me as why people do that. Because it's Chicago. And we call things what we want to call them, not necessarily what they're actually called. And I was a longtime Jewel employee, and I'm aware. It's so funny because I've been saying the Jewels for years on the air, and every time I say it, people get angry. Like we get phone calls. Like whoever's producing gets either a phone call or something. Like, doesn't he realize that it's Jewel and not the Jewels? Yeah, I realize it's Jewel and not the Jewels. But people in the city, people in Chicago go, let's go to the Jewels. It's like Soldier's Field.
Yeah. Or Barnes and Nobles.
It's but that's the way, you know, people talk in Chicago. Yeah, let's go to the Jewels. So I do it kind of, I absolutely know that the company is called Jewel. I used to get a paycheck from them that said Jewel on it. So I know. And I shop there. And my dad works there. So, all right. Let's get to some more here. Apple. That is a legendary logo that everybody knows. As soon as you see it, you know what it is. And it's on everybody's phone. Apple is the most innovative consumer electronics company in the world and has a cult-like following of loyal customers. Founded by the late, great Steve Jobs in 1976, the Apple logo has since become a worldwide icon. And McDonald's, of course. Over the years, the golden arches that make up the McDonald's M have been synonymous with fast, convenient food. This symbol can be spotted from a mile away on a sign-cluttered turnpike and draws in over 60 million people per day. McDonald's has undergone a few redesigns since their 1940 inception, but they made things cleaner with their 2003 revision. That's the last time it was revised. Pepsi, classic logo. Target, the Target logo. That's an iconic one. You immediately know what it is as soon as you see it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, how about Microsoft?
Yeah. There have been a few changes that I didn't like.
But to Microsoft?
Always, yeah. They've gone through a few different iterations.
Shell?
Shell's always,
Shell Gas?
Pretty much always been the same.
Pretty much, yeah. The first design was in 1900, and then they changed it. The only they changed it in 1948. And they removed the word Shell, though. Now it's just the Shell.
Yeah.
They removed that in 1999. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Starbucks.
Oh, man.
That's an iconic logo, and of course you get to see every other block. There's a Starbucks, so you get to see that. You get to see the mermaid.
I'm curious. Does that frustrate you? It frustrates me how often I walk past the Starbucks.
Well, yeah, I mean,
so many.
I don't go to Starbucks. I don't drink coffee, so it doesn't affect me at all. But yeah, I think there's too many. I mean, when we were working at the Tribune building, there was a Starbucks right next door. And a Starbucks right across the street. So you could literally stand in one Starbucks and look across the street at the other.
Yeah. Rick Pearson always used, he still does. He sends us on coffee runs for the whole station on Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
So I'd always get my pick. Oh, which Starbucks do
I want
to go to today?
Which Starbucks am I going
to
go to? Yeah. All right. Listen, we got to get out of here. But tomorrow on the show, Chicago Oddities and Curiosity Expo is happening. We're going to talk about that. The lovely Esmeralda Leon will be here, and of course, all the Friday features. So that's all coming up on the show tomorrow. All right, we got to take a break. The news is up after this.